Good evening, folks. We will get going here. Looks like we have a fairly lengthy agenda, so we'll try and get through this in good order. As always, we will begin with attendance. President Kuzmu.
Present.
Vice President Chillen. Vice President Woods.
Present.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Battelle.
Present.
Mr. Matthew for Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills. Pretty sure Councillor Mills is here. Can you hear me, Councillor Mills? She's here. Councillor Hanwell. Mr. McCougar for Councillor Bannister. Councillor Chivone. Councillor Mohammed. Councillor Grilke. Councillor Minarski. Councillor Valdez. Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redman. Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen.
Here.
Councillor Champagne. I think my volume is just really low. Thank you. Okay, there we go. Councillor Speechman.
Present.
Councillor Hodgson.
Present.
Councillor Twang.
Present.
Councillor Zhang.
Present.
Councillor Graham. Councillor Binchik.
Present.
Councillor Douglas.
Yeah.
Mr. Dumichel.
Here.
Okay, with that, as always, I will remind you of the oath you have taken, a couple of other speakers' business items, just a couple of announcements. First off, friendly reminder that for fall term, so starting next meeting, we are across the hall in room E1018, so it's the mirror image of this on the other side of the hallway. So if you walk into this room at 6 o'clock in 2 weeks and no one's here, you'll know where to find us. Couple of clarifications as well. One second here. On item 6A on the main agenda package, just to clarify, and I'm sure Councillor Hodgson will clarify any further as needed in his introduction, but the attached document, SC1309.02, is to be also considered principles of this legislation. So it's not supporting documentation, it is considered additional principles for this legislation. So it would be difficult to embed that flowchart in document, which is why it's featured later on. As well, a minor editorial amendment coming to item 6C that, because it hasn't been introduced, can just sort of happen. So item 6C, again, is on the main agenda package. If you look at the actual text that's used, I guess because it goes onto a second page, the third and fourth last be it resolved should actually be it further resolved. So just a minor editorial correction there. So just so you're aware of that. And again, I'm sure the introducers of that motion will make that clear when that time comes. Lastly, just a friendly reminder that the end of this meeting is your last chance to submit nominations for the fall or for the spring-summer council scholarship program. So I would encourage you to do so. I haven't got a lot of nominations yet, so I'm looking forward to getting some by the end of the meeting. If you need a couple minutes after the end of the meeting, just let me know and I can stick around if you need to grab a couple extra signatures or whatnot. There's forms there, so you can grab those at the recess or whatnot and fill those out, or if you have any that are already completed that you need to give to me, please give them to me. We will be determining the winners of the council scholarship at the next meeting. That is the end of my speaker's business. So with that, we will move into presentations. Item 2A, the SU's Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project, presented by Melanie Alexander and sponsored President Kuzmin.
Can I special order presentation?
Okay, you want to make a motion to make an item a special order?
Yeah, so we can, I don't know if you're the design of this, but if presentation 2C is special order to the main agenda, and just do time and space.
Okay, so it would already be sort of automatically included, because the presentation will include it on the main agenda. Are you looking to do it before the other presentations?
Yes.
Okay. So special order item 2C to take place immediately. Then.
Okay.
So President Kuzma moving to make item 2C a special order to be dealt with immediately. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Gropi, thank you very much. Special order requires a two-thirds majority vote. President Kuzma to introduce.
Sorry, I should have talked to the presenters ahead of time. But essentially, our general manager, Mark Michaud, he has a little bit of early today, and he's going to be presenting on the sub-renovations project. So that's why I think it would be important if we had that presentation first. And beyond that, I think it also, when we have a presentation on the joint entrance of washings, I think it would help the conversation. If we have an understanding of the sub-renovation project, and then we'll start talking about joint entrance of washings, which is kind of the component about students who can build up, etc. So, yeah, that's just kind of my rationale.
Okay, that item is not debatable, not amendable, and requires two-thirds majority vote. All those in favor of making item 2C special order? All those opposed? That motion is carried. Okay, with that, then we are on item 2C, sub-renovation update sponsored by Vice President Lay. Do we have a seconder for that presentation? Vice President Woods, thank you very much. Any objection to hearing the presentation? Seeing none, we will proceed. And I am going to double check what's going on in Skype here. Okay. Just give me one sec here. Guys, I'm just going to disconnect you from Skype and start a new call because I'm not sure what happened here. Okay, I think we've got both of you again, so you guys can listen in. Point of parliamentary inquiry?
Yes, please.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Is it possible to change the minutes at all?
You mean the votes and proceedings?
No, just like the minutes. My name has been spelled incorrectly.
I fixed that.
You're talking about on...
It's on the online one.
Okay. Thank you. And yeah, just a reminder that, yeah, if there are any corrections of that nature that need to happen, you're more than welcome to email myself and Nicole with them, and we'll make that happen. I'm going to switch back over here. All right.
I'm so sorry, guys. Oh, it's so small, I can't tell where I'm going. Okay.
Play?
Up. I never do it that way. All right, so first, thanks for, and thank you to Melanie, her presenters for letting me go first, too. I appreciate it. I normally would have presented this in September, but I'm going to be here in September, so I wanted to give you guys a chance to ask me any questions about how our renovation is going before I get started, or before I leave for the month. What I will say is, in this specific presentation, I'm not going to give you any exact numbers for what parts of... I will give you some exact numbers as to changes in our budget, but not as to what exactly some things cost. The reason for that is we don't want to give intelligence to people that are going to be bidding for our work right now. We want to keep that a little... we don't want to kind of tell them how much they can bid that we can afford. We're trying to keep it cheaper. If you do want to know that, we could go in camera, although it doesn't really affect the end result of things. So a quick update for you. This is our current project status. In terms of the tower, we finished the fourth floor, and the Dean of Students partially is moving in this week, actually. The third floor, which is where we're going to be relocating the chaplains, will be done this week, and they'll move throughout the month of sometime in September onto the third floor. The sixth floor will be complete by the end of September. That's really exciting because that's where, perhaps not until the renovations further along, we have the space. But there will be a council office there, and you'll love it. It's glorious. Has a great view. It's nicely furnished. It's going to be fantastic, and you're going to say that was awesome. There will also be a new conference and committee room up there for counselors to use for all their meetings. We're finishing around kitchen this week. I'm told that we'll open, reopen on Thursday. I've already made plans to be there. And we are on budget and on time with the power reservations. Second thing is, second phase that we're going to enter into will be the lower level renovations. We'll begin these when we receive funding approval from the Alberta Capital Finance Authority. That comes after a motion is passed at the Premier Cabinet authorizing the transaction. We don't know when that's going to be for sure. We expect it by the end of September. I'll come back to that in a second. The lower level will be phased. We're going to begin with the west end of the building where the chaplains are. When that's done, we're going to move to the center of the lower level, the south center part, and we're going to get the services, and then finally we'll do the subprint and the decant space where we have our services temporarily decant. We expect to begin that phase in early October 2013 and to finish sometime in August 2014. And that goes out to tender this week. So we're working on that throughout the winter. We're going to try to accommodate, try to minimize disruption, of course, during the exam periods. The third key part of the project is the atrium plaza. You know, we'd actually hoped to be able to excavate this year, but when we got past design development into actually looking at verifying some of the assumptions that the consultants made, turns out we had a few utilities we had to move around, and that created some problems, which I'm going to talk about at some point. We're now targeting to begin digging, excavating in March or April of 2014, and we should be done the atrium in the plaza around October, November of 2014. And we'll follow that up the following spring by finishing up the landscaping. The fourth component and the bane of my existence is what you call site services. So your gas lines, your storm sewers, and things like that. So we're digging down into a built-up area, into an area that has a lot of stuff going on in it already. So we've had to miss, there's a big, I think it was a Tulador tunnel, underground tunnels, we've had to arrange to miss that. But we have to add new storm sewers, we have to relocate existing storm sewers, and we have to move a gas line. This has posed some problems because this was a scope of work that we didn't fully anticipate. We anticipated some of it, but not all of it when we did our budgeting. So it's created some significant budget and schedule challenges, which I'll talk about in a second. Part one of the storm sewer relocation was completed. We're divided into a couple parts. It's been completed already. That's what the digging was in August. And it was very quick, completed very quickly and under the budget that the revised budget that we had for that part of the work. The site services, this is where it's problematic. They're very weather dependent. You can't really dig a storm sewer in the middle of winter. You might be able to drive a gas line, but you can't do depending on how you do it, but you can't dig a storm sewer, apparently. I've learned a lot about site services in the last few minutes. The thing is, these things need to be completed before we can begin excavating for the atrium and the plaza, because basically they're in the way. We have to move. On the good side of things, we recently found out this week that ATCO will be realigning the gas line at their expense. I'll cover what that means in a second. So I'm going to go through three slides of talking about the challenges we're facing with the project, just so you're aware, and you can ask me any questions you want about them at all. First, with site services, there's two key areas. There's schedule risk and budget risk. The schedule risk, because it was a wet summer, there was a lot of problems with everything storm sewer being apparent, and all of a sudden, all these companies that do storm sewer work got really busy. And also, they can't work a lot when it's really raining, because when you dig a trench and it rains, it fills full of water. So you lose half a day in just getting the water back out of the trench before you can continue. It's dried up since in August, so they're starting to catch up, which is great for us. But that's one of the things that's kind of slowed us down. And we've also had some issues with the university and the consultants and getting the designs approved on time. We are still on schedule to get this done before the winter frees up. And we have to get it done if we're going to start excavation in the spring. The second one is the move of the ATCO gas line. We've given ATCO a deadline. We don't really have any leverage over them if they don't hit it, but we've given them a deadline several months in advance of when we want to start our own excavation. The good thing about this is initially ATCO Prompt said they'd pay for the move. Then they said they wouldn't, because they got in a bit of a fight with the university about the rights to the land. And now ATCO has basically said, okay, we give up. We'll just move the line entirely off of the university's property. And we're like, that's awesome, because we don't want to pay it. That can be very happy. Here's the budget risk, though. We budgeted about $250 million to move to the storm sewer originally, what we thought it would be. Turns out the scope of work expanded considerably, and at one point our budget was like $1 million for that instead of $250,000. We've since got that back down, and we're adopting some strategies I'll talk about in a second for mitigating that. But we do expect it to come in between $400K and $600K more than $1,000 more than initially expected. So I, as an executive player, I haven't slept up all this summer. That has forced us to take a really hard look at our budget and where we're at. So here's where we are sitting with the budget steps. The tower is going to be on budget. And we have a very high degree of confidence that our interior lower-level renovation will be on budget. And why do we have a high level of confidence? Because it's work we've done. We do renovations every year. We have a good idea of what it's going to cost. We have good experience for the contractor in terms of how they were on the tower. And to be honest, they were actually really good. We thought we had some problems with the rat stuff, and it turns out that everything came in almost dead on budget. And it, yeah, so we're very comfortable with that. For the plaza and the atrium, we have a medium to high level of confidence that we'll hit budget. We don't think there's going to be any specific problems we're going to have. It's been well engineered. It's been reviewed. More importantly, there are probably some, if we run into any issues, there are some design changes that we can change the type of glass that we use that will save us some money. So we're pretty comfortable we're going to hit that. The site services, we have a medium level of confidence in a revised budget bracket. I think that it's pretty close. I don't think we'll go over 600, but I won't say we won't go to 750 over the budget. I think we'll be more like $400,000 over the budget, but I don't know that for sure yet. So that's a medium level of confidence. So, where does that leave us overall? Well, first, let's talk about how we're mitigating and what the offsets are to this unexpected expense. First, we are delaying sending the atrium plaza work out for bid because how much you get charged by these subcontractors is actually affected to a significant extent by the time of year. If you're looking forward 4 or 6 months, you're a contractor, and you haven't got anything booked, and a lot of people are doing stuff in the middle of winter, you want to book it up because that's sure money. Otherwise, it's uncertainty. So they are sometimes more willing, because there's less work coming to market in the winter, they're more willing to give a bit of a break. So we're going to delay the plaza bid package, and we expect improved pricing as a result. We are carrying contingencies of about $750,000 in the budget because we did expect that there would be things we didn't anticipate. Every renovation the SU or the university or anybody's ever done in the world has things. We ran ours pretty close, so if we end up spending it, it's perfect. It's not perfect, but it's okay. We had an over budget in that in contingencies, which is what I was really worried about at the beginning too. Anyways, we do not want to spend all of this on site services. However, we want to make sure we have money set aside to cover other things that should come forward in the rest of the project. We have saved $100,000 out of the budget because Zach was going to move the line at their own cost, which is awesome. And we are pursuing several additional sources of funding for the project. First, the university has an energy management program, which can provide, we don't know where it'll end up, but we think that they'll probably pony up at least $135,000 and get the $360,000 for the project. That is a project the university does where they take what they did originally, a loan, and then they use that to fund sustainability initiatives. They would cost out how much they would save in utilities, and then charge that back, and then credit that back to the loan, and that's how they're doing it here. We're going to save a lot of money every year, actually, for heating, ventilation, and cooling costs because of this renovation. I was blown away at how much. Because we're only touching a part of the building, we're going to save, $50,000 to $70,000 a year. It's great. Secondly, we have raised $190,000 to date from our business partners, tenants in the food court and student care. And we haven't even begun our formal corporate or individual fundraising program. We're starting that in the fall or winter. So in the big picture, we're still very concerned, but we had a meeting about it last week, and our project manager remains very confident we'll come in within the original $13.4 million budget. Second challenge we've had is approvals. This is basically, we're waiting for the government to tell us if we're going to be able to proceed with our preferred financing model. The budget risk, it shouldn't be delayed. There's two things. One is interest rates are on a fairly steep ascent, which changes the amount you have to pay each year or the term. Now we put a lot of slack into the estimates, so I think we should be fine. But if we let it sit for a year, we will be more challenged. It won't be, but it is a bit of a risk. Secondly, the contractors. It's really important to keep a project moving and keep it cost efficient to keep people busy. If they're not busy, they go and do other stuff. And if they're not available for you, you have to wait for them, and you're stuck with the cost of that delay. So we're trying to keep it moving as much as we can. Our contractors already actually, on the lower level stuff, been delayed more than we would have liked. So we don't think it's going to be delayed past September, but that is a risk. The overall thing is, the other risk is schedule risk. For the project as a whole, from start to completion, if we get it 2 months later, it won't really affect it, because the mitigating factor for that is that the big atrium side of the project. However, it will affect our ability to convert the space back into usable space for our student services in a timely fashion. So that it's more of an internal risk that we carry there. Overall, the project remains within budget, on schedule, despite the challenges we've had financially. And that's because we've done additional fundraising and we have those contingency provisions. The tower portion of the project is on track. You are going to love this new student government center. You really will. We may be using it for some temporary space for other areas to start with. But I know that Brent's going to be pushing me to get this new one. Brent and actually Craig. Craig's actually seen the space and he's like, wow, that's pretty awesome. Secondly, the key schedule threats we're concerned about right now is the finalization of that financing approval, when that's going to happen, and whether we can complete the site servicing before spring 2014. And that's really up to ATCO. The two key financing concerns are changing interest rates, because I don't know if a lot of you are aware of this, but actually interest rates for bonds have spiked in the last 2 or 3 months if you're a finance guy. And a lot faster than I expected. I didn't see that coming. And but we are covered on it. We actually have coverage of about another 1.5% before we start to get in trouble with the viability of the project. So we got a long ways to go, but it makes me nervous. And the site servicing costs. We don't have a firm cost, and to mitigate the cost, we've broken the site servicing into components, and instead of going with what we're doing with everything else, which is called a guaranteed maximum price, so we're putting these parts of the project out to bid. They come back, that's the price. That's it. That's a guaranteed price to them for them to deliver. We're not doing that with site servicing, because the guaranteed prices they were coming back to us with were ridiculous. $4,000 for a meter of storm sewer? No way. It's just crazy. It's just insane prices. And so far, we tried that approach called cost plus with a portion of the storm sewer work, and it came in far less than what we would have paid for in GMP. So for that part of it, we're going to take a little bit more of a risk. The key wins so far, though, because it's some good news. That the good stuff is we've got $190,000 that we did when we started the project. For the project, ATCO is going to basically save us $100,000 by their decision, and our tower is on budget and reasonably on schedule. And that's what I wanted to say before I take off for my vacation. So if you guys have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Any questions? Councilor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was curious what the... how confident are you will get the what's called energy management program grant? Like, I see a range there, but like, we're guaranteed to get some, or?
I think that the budget stuff the university is going through may or may not. I don't know if it's in fact it shouldn't, but from the way the program is structured, but I just don't know that for sure. I'm reasonably confident because we met several times with the people who run the program, and they they're waiting for our consultant now to just verify the calculations that he made previously. So the variation there, I think we'll get something. I think the variation is going to be whether... So the catch is, they've done a bit of work this summer that actually contributes to it as well, and they've paid for it in a different way. But they let us include that in our calculations. The number's a lot higher than if it's just the part that we're directly covering. So we'll see.
Councilor Schiavone?
So you mentioned that we haven't even started the fall like corporate financing or fundraising. I don't know if you're at liberty to discuss this, but how much does that typically bring in for this sort of thing?
We haven't done it. We didn't do it in the last two renovations. We did it in the 93 renovation. But that campaign was more targeted towards individuals. We actually are explicitly targeting want to target corporates more, because basically $100,000 donation is a lot, like it's a lot more time and resource effective to go after that than something else. We're not going to pursue it until we come back with a plan and show you what we want to do, because you guys have to decide whether that's something you want to do. The stuff that we've gotten so far, none of it redounds to the benefit of the business partner. Basically, we strong-armed the people who wanted leases in our food court, and student care. We are naming something for student care, but we're going to name it after my predecessor. The committee we're going to name will be the Bill Smith Committee. We're trying to decide if we want to have a funny picture of Bill or a formal picture of Bill. So, anyways, any more questions,
Councillor Hodgson?
My question.
Okay, Councillor Bitchett.
I'm just wondering, is there any downsides to doing the corporate fundraising, since you said that you will be discussing it prior to actually commencing it?
Not everyone thinks that we should. So, some people don't like the idea of having named things. I think that's less of an issue now among students than it was 10 or 15 years ago. However, students are very sensitive to who gets to attach their name to things that are close to them. So, you know, if you want easy money, honestly, probably Synovus is probably a pretty easy mark to get a good amount of money. But I imagine our people here would be like, there's no goddamn way we're having Synovus Plaza in front of our building. And I think that's something that council has to decide. Maybe you decide we don't want that at all, and that's fine too, and that's absolutely fine. We're just kind of preparing the proposal. The one exception is the student care one. It was a way for us to close the deal, and they're not doing anything for them specifically. And the ones for the, like I said, the ones for the food court, they just give us money.
Governor Kelly?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the presentation. Now, worst case scenario, let's say that the interest rates do rise, and so you mentioned that maybe the feasibility of the project or certain aspects of the project would be challenged.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what is the worst case scenario contingency plan we have?
Worst case scenario is that we go to 25 years versus 20 years on the fee assessment. I really want to keep it to 20. I think 25 is too long. The Board of Governors approved the financing arrangement that ranged up, I think it was 4.75. over 25 years, and the numbers still work. So we have lots of room. We were hoping when we did it that we could get a 20-year line at 3.25%. And that would have left us in better, actually, honestly, slightly better financial condition than we are today. So we have a bit of leeway there as well. We are a little concerned also about what the future of enrollment is. So that 20 to 25 year decision is something that we'll decide when we know what the rate's going to be.
So even if worse things happen, interest rates skyrocket, I mean, worse.
We're going to be okay.
Cool.
President Kuzma.
I just want to, on behalf of the executive committee, at least, I'm pretty sure the rest of council would agree. Like, thanks a lot for the good work that you've been doing. I know it's been a pain in the ass understanding what a sewer system is and how all these gas pipelines and et cetera work. So thanks for losing a lot of sleep on that. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilor Hodgson?
Yeah,
if there's any more questions,
Councilor Schmoy?
Just one more. In terms of the actual gas, you said now they're in charge of moving that gas line. But we're kind of dependent on them for this excavation. As of recently, like, how confident are we that it's going to be done on time? And if it's not done on time, how far behind does that put us?
That's actually a really hard question.
Sorry.
Because I don't know. So what happened with this was originally we approached them, and they said, "Sure, we'll move it for free. If you give us a right of way." And we're like, "We're not the university. We've got to talk to the university." The university went to them and said, "We're not giving you a damn right of way. We'll give you something else," which was pretty reasonable. The university offer was actually pretty reasonable. And then there was a period of about a month and a half where they're like, "No, then you're going to have to pay for it all yourself," and blah, 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 blah. The university pushed back a little more, and we just found out like five or ten days ago that ACCO, at a senior level, decided, "To hell with this. We want to own our right-of-way. The university won't give it. We're now going to put it around 87th Avenue and wrap around campus." Great. Except that there's a big project that we're also involved in that's on that corner. So we don't know how that's going to interfere. We've made them aware of what our timeline is, and they're going to try to abide by that because I think it opens them up to some potential liability if they get in our way, and I think they're aware of that. But we'll have to see. The thing is, the gas line, the university technically could just, they can cut it up. The problem is that the university would then be liable because the gas line feeds Windsor Park. So if any of you live in Windsor Park and your gas goes out, you can know what it means. So if ACCO really wants to solve the problem, and we've given them a deadline of December 31st. Now it's a little different, I don't fully get this, but the engineers tell me it's a little different with the gas line. They can do it more in the winter because they do what's called directional drilling. You can do it with an oil well. They just kind of drill a hole in the ground and snake it around. So versus what you typically do, you can do a little bit of that with the storm sewer. The storm sewer is so big in comparison that it's basically a cut and date, which can mean it's hard to cut into the winter, in the middle of winter. And more expensive, so I get that soon.
Any other questions?
To answer your question, I have no idea what you got, but I give you a number, but I just don't know. We're trying to find out more as we go.
Fair enough.
As President Kuzma said, thank you for the new show. With that, we'll move on to item 2A, the SU Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project, presented by Melanie Alexander and sponsored by President Kuzma. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Yes, Councillor Speakman. Any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, we will proceed. I think I heard about it.
Oh, do you? Okay, cool. Yeah. So, I guess just a super quick introduction. This is Alexis. She's from ISMIS, Institute for Sexual and Minorities. And this is Melanie. She's from the Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project from the CS Union. And today they'll be presenting on gender-inclusive washrooms. This is something that we've been talking a lot about, at least on the executive committee level. For this year, and also a bit of last year, and I figured perhaps rather than just us talking about it all the time, it would be best to just throw this into this council court. Why? Because if we do decide to pursue this, it may cost us a bunch of money, in which case student council will probably have to approve of it at the end. So, hopefully you folks enjoyed the presentation, and thanks. And did you want me to pass around some of that as well?
Yeah, sweet. Yeah, no worries. Cool.
So you guys have a half hour, including questions.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about the gender-inclusive washrooms. Like Petra said, my name is Melanie Alexander, and I'm with the Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project.
I'm Alexis Slater, and I'm with the Institute for Sexual Minority Studies and Services, ISMIS.
So just to give you a little overview of what we are going to be talking about, so we're just going to give you a little introduction about the Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project. Then we're going to talk about what all gender or gender-inclusive washrooms are and why they're important. Then we're going to give you some examples of gender-inclusive washroom initiatives that have been done at other post-secondary institutions. And also talk about the gender-inclusive washroom initiatives that we've already taken here at the University of Alberta. And then talk a bit about our multi-cell gender-inclusive washroom proposal in sub and the community consultation that we've taken so far. And then at the end, we're going to be asking you for some guidance around future consultation with washrooms. So first, just to give you an explanation about the Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project, we're a two-year students' union project that's been funded by the Status Women Canada. So We focus on reducing gender-based violence in our community through education, awareness, and institutional change. So some of the things that we have done have been bringing in high-profile speakers, running workshops. We did a community theater project. We've been doing residence training. We did some anti-oppression training for Students Union executive and staff. Doing feminist self-defense, memorial march for missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and also within our institutional change piece has been working on gender-inclusive washrooms on campus.
My turn. Awesome. So I'm going to be talking about what are all gender or gender-inclusive washrooms. So these are washrooms that can be used by anyone, regardless of gender identification. These are typically called in other places gender-neutral washrooms. They can be called unisex washrooms or family washrooms. So that's the washroom that we're talking about. Nothing super special or mysterious, just a washroom that can be used by anyone regardless of their gender. And leading to the importance of why these washrooms are, you know, a really important initiative here on campus, I'm just going to read some quotes that are in the documents that you have, but I think they really speak to this importance. So first is from an alum. My experience as a transgender person at the U of A would have been different if gender-inclusive washrooms had been available. By having gender-inclusive bathroom facilities at the U of A would be sending a message of acceptance and awareness of those who do not fit within the gender binary. And then also moving in towards the importance of these washrooms, not just for gender-varying or trans individuals, but for all individuals. A quote from an education facilitator, she said, "The student I support uses a wheelchair and requires my assistance to use the washroom. I am female and my student is male. Having to make the decision of whose dignity will be compromised by entering a washroom of the wrong sex provides just one more barrier to inclusion and true accessibility, especially when the hallway is full of staring strangers and students." Similarly, these washrooms will benefit not only gender-varied individuals such as transgender, androgynous, genderqueer, and two-spirited people, but also parents with children of a different gender, people with disabilities who have a personal care attendant, people with chronic illness, and people requiring increased privacy, individual spaces, or that accessibility piece that we're talking about as well. And then, getting more into the health and emotional risks that are associated with using a traditional gendered space, an all-male or all-female washroom, from the report that we put forward. For those individuals who do not identify within the male-female binary or who are trans-identified, etc., and the other individuals that we've mentioned, some of the risks can be high levels of stress and anxiety around having to choose a safe washroom, increased isolation due to an institution's adherence to the strict male-female binary, physical and verbal assault, and then health problems due to bodily damage from holding it. And I can speak from experience from people that have come to me, talked about an issue here on campus, that they do not use a washroom until they are at home. They won't go between classes because there aren't any safe spaces identified on campus for them to use a washroom, and they will experience those health risks from not having access to a safe space. And so a washroom, for example, that we're going to be talking about in SEV, a high-level, high-visibility area, multi-user washroom, can be one step to addressing that important issue.
So next we're just going to give some examples of what exists at other universities. So first, the University of Toronto has also identified all their all-gender washrooms on a map. University of British Columbia has a list of where all their all-gender washrooms are located, and they're currently renovating their Students' Union buildings, so I have heard that there's like plans to make multi-stall gender-inclusive washrooms in the newly renovated building. We also have the University of Victoria, and they have multi-stall gender-inclusive washrooms, so they took two existing gendered washrooms and they changed the signage, and now they've been functioning for over a year as multi-stall gender-inclusive washrooms. We have Dalhousie. They have an all-gender washroom list, and they're also currently renovating their residence, and there is a push to also have all-gender and gender-inclusive spaces in their residences. McGill, they not only did they map the gender-inclusive washrooms on campus, they also re-signed them. So this was the new signage that they put up on the washrooms that already existed. A lot of the previous signage has unisex, so it just has male-female binary on it. Same with University of Regina. they were able to do a map and locate all the washrooms on campus, and then they also were able to do this signage that also identifies that people can use the space regardless of gender identity or expression. And Western University have multi-cell gender-inclusive washrooms, so very similar to what University of Victoria has. Some other institutions are Queen's, University of Winnipeg, York, University of Waterloo.
Not to mention countless universities and institutions within the state that have been doing this work for a lot longer than Canada has. Oh, great, good. So, moving forward on some of the things that are happening right now, tomorrow we're launching an all-gender washroom map. So, about a year ago, the Gender-Based Violence Prevention Project started the washroom committee, and I've been a part of that. We had volunteers, including SafeWalk and people from all over campus, come together to map out all of the washrooms on campus that are unisex or just labeled washroom or washrooms like that I was talking about before, single-user washrooms. And then we had Veronica Krasovich from University Digital Strategies map them on the university map system in an accessible map format, so kind of starting to align with some institutions what they've been doing already. And this is a huge step towards accessibility, so starting to get at the issue of not having a safe space to use a washroom between classes. And also what's nice about this is it's iPhone friendly, and so you can isolate them on your iPhone and view them very well, as opposed to downloading a PDF, so trying to make it more accessible in a lot of different ways.
And just to touch on the need for this, I had a friend who was trans who was working in a specific building and was unaware that there was actually a unisex washroom that they could have actually used, and instead they walked halfway across the campus. So it's really addressing kind of just the need right now is that we don't have the multi-cell gender-inclusive washrooms on campus, but we really need to increase the awareness that there are some spaces on campus that people might feel safer accessing. So then, just to talk a little bit about what we're proposing quickly about the multi-cell gender-inclusive washrooms and stuff. So what we've written a proposal and put forward to executive to renovate the east entrance washrooms in the Students' Union building and change them into gender-inclusive multi-stall washrooms. So it would be what we would see the example at University of Victoria. We are hoping to really take some time and actually do some consultation of what we want those washrooms to look like. So to give you a description of the community consultation that we've done so far, so we've written a proposal that has been seen by past exec and current exec, and we did consultation mostly with all the student groups, student services in the building, and we did some various student group consultations. So we actually, while we were developing the proposal, we met with them and we got lots of feedback during the writing the proposal, so they actually put a lot of input into it. And then we also just talked to them about what they thought might be potential concerns and addressing their issues first. But we did get a lot of positive feedback, and all the people that we talked to in the SU services were supportive, and the student groups that we've talked to so far have been really supportive. And so the next piece and why we're here is to talk about future community consultation. So the SU executive has requested that we do more consultation with the community about these washrooms before talking about how we can go through with this project. So why we're here is to get some feedback on what would be adequate consultation. So before moving forward with our process, we wanted to make sure that we at least had this conversation with what council would feel like would be adequate consultation to make this project happen. And we can also start with questions first before moving to that piece, if people have just general questions about all the things we talked about.
Sure. And this is a presentation, so a lot of the rules go out the window. So when I say that we normally can't have sort of general conversation without, it sort of goes out the window for presentations. It's there 30 minutes, so if they want to use some of it for conversation, then we'll certainly facilitate it in the same way as questions. And I'm sure if questions come up during that, they'd be happy to answer them. So we'll open the floor up to questions and or comment. Councilor Mohammed.
What sort of opposition have you guys faced by this?
Most opposition is cost, so they're pretty expensive. The the style that we really do want to go to, and we really appreciate that the exec does want to go that route, is floor-to-ceiling washrooms, or sorry, floor-to-ceiling stalls. So there's more privacy. I think it also is just like a nicer washroom, and also the washroom that we're looking at, we would actually have to like renovate pipeline, like toilets, everything. So it just, the cost is pretty intense. Most of the feedback has been, there are people who are like, I don't know if I would use this washroom, and it's like, you don't have to use the washroom. And once there's that kind of moment of like realizing that we're creating it for a certain community that needs it, a lot of people have been really on board with it, so we haven't actually had very much opposition at all.
A lot of really good supportive comments too from a lot of the stakeholder groups, and also just the general population and faculty that I work with too. A lot of the it's about time, this is great. Yeah. So it's been good.
Councillor Binchik.
Just wondering, what consultation did you already do besides this? Is this just a starting point, or have you already done?
So, like, in general, the timeline of consultation, the Gender Inclusive Washroom Committee formed of October of last year. So on that committee was certain stakeholders, and we also had people on it who were part of initiatives to get gender-inclusive washrooms on campus in, like, the early 2000s or so. So we started with that, just trying to figure out, like, what was the knowledge, like, what has already happened on campus. And then building on that, we had a committee, and then Alexis and I took on writing the proposal, and so the committee provided feedback throughout the proposal. Once we had the first draft, the first draft went to all the SU services, and then the SU services gave us a whole bunch of feedback. Then we met with, I don't know how many, a couple of student groups, and that's kind of the consultation we've done so far. Mm-hmm. We did have a CSL student this summer who worked out some research framework moving forward of a community consultation, so we haven't gone forward with that yet because we want to have a conversation with council first. But.
Councilor Shimoni?
To clarify, you guys mentioned that there are already some like single washrooms that are gender inclusive, but there's no multi-stall washrooms. Is that what you said?
That's right. Yep.
Thanks.
Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. And three sort of questions/points. First one being, and maybe this is in the back of this, but I'm just curious what the budget is kind of looking like right now, or as well as that proposal. But maybe it's just better you bring it to us in the future. But if you can just maybe give a little bit more information around that. Second was what, like, how do you see this project going forward? Like, I'm curious, like, if we build one gender inclusive washroom in sub like that east washroom, like, what would be the next step, or like, I don't know, what is it? Like your long-term vision kind of thing. And then third, just on the topic of consultation, like I see you consulted a lot of groups that were kind of overarching, representing other groups, like big umbrella groups. I guess seeing consultation from some of those groups that like that overarching group represents would make me feel like a little bit better, specifically just in the Chaplains Association, so like some of the individual religious groups maybe. As well as just maybe a random smattering of student groups on campus.
I don't have a really long list, so I'll let it slide and remind Councillor Hodgson that it's best to ask one question at a time.
So the first question, with the two options of the washroom, the one being what they did in University of Victoria, which is just changing the signage. So all they did was take down the sign and put the sign back up. That ran them about $2,000 to $3,000. That is the cheap option for these washrooms, which is not typically what exec has been wanting to do, which I think is awesome, but it's a lot more expensive. It's plumbing, so I don't know, hundreds of thousand dollars. Like, I don't know, like $200,000, $300,000. It's hard to know, and we don't really have that information, but the next step would be also getting actual written, like, estimates and stuff. So, and this hasn't really been done so far.
I think President Kuzmin wants to add on to that, so.
Yeah. So right now, two things. Now, this can't come with the students, like the sub-renovation project, because the sub-renovation project, when students voted on it, they voted for a very specific set of things and promises. And considering that the budget is like already looking pretty tight, that's kind of problematic. That's why, like, if we are to pursue this, this has to be kind of like another capital expenditure. So in case you folks are wondering. But with that being said, on our end, we're trying to see if we can get our architects and like some of the folks, even though like you can't come on the sub-rental project, we're trying to see if we can use resources we really, the folks working on the project to give us like an estimate of the cost. So that way it's easier to work with, like especially on Melanie and Alexis's end. And Melanie mentioned to me like in last time that there's possibilities for maybe external funding. So like there's a possibility for that to happen. And the other part of like why I think it's really good that they're presenting to council is like if at the end of the day, let's say council is voting on it, I think it would be important for them to know, like, you know, besides how much this thing may cost, like, what would council need to know in order to vote, let's say, in favor of it or something, right? Like, what kind of threshold information or consultation is necessary for them? So you guys have that, folks have that critical impetus to, let's say, be in favor of this project, is kind of the way I see it. Because, let's say, you know, if you bring it back to council later, it's like we have this price tag. We don't want it, and we do a whole bunch of work about the designs and everything. We don't want to just like let's say be like, oh, we don't want it because we have a certain consultation. That's why they're kind of doing this step now in terms of presenting to council. So I imagine like besides you know getting feedback of what this consultation will look like now, I'm pretty sure they can maybe have like a deadline for which councilors can email feedback. Maybe.
Yeah,
yeah,
we could work something out.
Yeah, so they can just email back the dates and the council. But that's kind of why this is all happening right now in terms of why council is getting the presentation and what it's looking like for the cost. So why we don't have a good idea of the cost yet. And the reason why we don't have a good idea of the cost yet is because the architects and the folks working on Subreno are still too busy on Subreno, so that's probably that's kind of the challenge. So
thank you. Councilor Binchik.
I think I'll pass. All of my questions will probably pertain to like the next step after you guys are ready and all the budgets.
Okay. Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. I think this is a great initiative. I'm really excited that the university and the Students Union have a chance to be involved. So thank you very much for coming and presenting. Please keep up the great work. But did you folks or did the exec have any sort of preliminary ideas on what might be good additional consultation? Did you have any thoughts in terms of talking to students? Or just curious because,
So our CSL student did do research framework. She was with a course for community research, and the framework that she did come up with was doing like a more like mass large survey. And we modeled it after looking at the surveys that UVic did, University of Regina, lots of other universities have kind of had to go about this process. Normally their council or their executive has asked for it. So based on that, it was looking at more of doing like a larger survey. I don't know if anyone saw, like we did a gender-based violence campus survey last year. So just trying to do like a general whatever. We would keep it really short. So the surveys that they've done have been about 5 questions. It's basically like, do you know, like giving people information about the washrooms, but basically just trying to gauge what is going to be the concern, if there is a concern, and kind of really getting at that question at, even if you weren't to use these washrooms, are you comfortable with them existing? Because there is going to be a large portion of the student population that may not use these washrooms or think about it, but really actually agree with having them there. And I think they're going to service a lot more people. So that was one idea of doing consultation. We've also had, like, just some feedback from executive about different forms of consultation, like if we just did a focus group of, like, 30 students at random or that kind of thing. But
Councilor Patel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. I was wondering why you selected those washrooms and some in particular to be converted because they see a lot of traffic and maybe why you're doing it, but I'd like to know a little more.
Yeah, I'll start. That's actually one of the key reasons. So high traffic, it's key entry, high visibility. It sends a level of student and institutional support and visibility. And so that's something that is really important for this.
Also, those washrooms
they're on the main level, which is ideal, and they also aren't a lot. I think there are about 4 stalls in each washroom. So compared to any other, the only other main level washrooms are the really large west side washrooms that are already really wheelchair accessible, which is awesome. And so these washrooms currently, like, we did our own, like, own audit based on like an online thing, and there's issues with some of the doors not being quite wide enough. They're old washrooms, they're not that nice. So I think ideally it makes sense to renovate those ones, and we're also not looking to change a large amount of these washrooms in sub into gender inclusive washrooms. I think it's an appropriate amount.
But and it's a good juxtaposition, I think, to some of the work that's been gone into the map as well, because for the single use ones, because a lot of these are in really obscure, hard to find places, and it's fine that we've mapped them now, but that's just really one piece of the puzzle and a short step. And so this, in contrast, is high visibility, high traffic, so to contrast that need.
And a lot of the research that you can find based out of the states, who are like about 3 or 4 years ahead of a lot of what's going on in Canada, they've really outlined what is really important to have for gender inclusive washrooms, and high traffic and high visibility are like the highest ones. So.
And again, reminder that the presenters are happy to take your feedback in addition to your questions. Councillor Schiavone.
Yes, thanks.
Councillor Hodgson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just going back to the other question I had before, just about long-term vision on campus. I'm just curious.
Well, you can jump in and correct me, but I think one is great, but multiple multi-stall washrooms is an ultimate goal in different buildings, different places, and other larger centers, larger buildings on campus. I'd personally like to see that move forward.
Yeah, and I think it's about, like, we're lucky in a, we're in a place where we can actually try this, right? Like, we can give it a shot and set an example across campus. And I think, really, if you look at the patterns of how this issue is progressing on campus, it really has been students that have called out for it, and the university typically tends to be a little bit behind on it. So it's really about setting an example, showing people what would actually be a good thing, and moving forward and asking out of the university to make it more accessible.
Councillor Speakman.
Yeah, hi. I have some suggestions for wider consultation. I think it'd be cool to see on that list maybe some more disparate student groups from outside of SUB would be great to see on that list. As well, maybe some of the staff that work on the main floor of SUB in the food court, or the even like people at the travel center, see if it's relevant to them. And then also the place that washroom, and then it's really close to the Dinwiddie Lounge upstairs. Horowitz, thank you, that's it. the Horowitz Theater, which is like not only used by students but like the community at large for concerts and events and everything like that. So I think it would be maybe really beneficial for the project if can find some people that are supportive or to be consulted from those types of people.
Councilman Nguyen.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. It was awesome. I was just wondering, you talked a lot about how, like, which universities have this in place already. I was wondering if you came across any universities that had either had, like, problems putting something into place, or how about putting that into place, and if there's anything that you learned from that in your consultation and in your proposal?
I think all of these universities had so much trouble putting any of this in place.
Yes.
So I've had personal like conference calls with about 3 universities, and all of them really struggled, and it was a challenge. It was a lot of like trying to get, obviously, like the funds for certain ones of them. The all-gender map doesn't seem to be that difficult. It's just basically there needs to be someone who's like, I'm going to actually take my time to do this. Yeah, and it takes a long time to be able to do that. It was a lot of volunteer hours. So I think it's the energy is the one like huge barrier, but I think a lot of people have had similar process like challenges. With U of R, they had so much problems with actually facilities and operations, because they changed all their signages on their unisex washrooms all over campus. But facilities and operations didn't actually ask them what they wanted on the sign before they printed them. So they lucked out and they said something decent, but it wasn't. They had, I think they had like the male/female sign, which they said they didn't want because they really just wanted like a toilet or a washroom. So there's been a lot of issues of miscommunications around like the people who are actually doing the, like, putting it forward and the people who implement it and not actually like connecting there. I think with U of R, they had really good support from their university, not great support from their students union, and really bad support from facilities and operations. With like UVic, they had some challenges with the SU, but it actually worked out. Like when they went to council, it actually got voted through and it was really positive. But there's like been various challenges for all of them.
Okay. Councillor Binchik?
Are you looking at transforming any Washington South side of staff? And if yes, are you expecting any opposition from the university administration? And I also have a matter part of the question. No? Okay.
We've only got a few minutes left, so I'll put you back on the list. But.
Thank you. So one step moving forward, I think, and again, jump in if I'm speaking out of turn, would be, so once we've isolated and kind of like mapped single-use washrooms, for example, is actually aligning the signage to be more gender inclusive, because as Mel said, you know, a male/female symbol is not as inclusive as a toilet or washroom or whatever. So finding some kind of common language to label washrooms would be wonderful, but I foresee some challenges with F&O down the road, just given some of the research that we've done. That would be one next step and perhaps a potential challenge.
Yeah, and I think some universities have tried to adopt policies that every building that gets built on campus moving forward has gender-inclusive washrooms. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually sure what the status is with other universities, and we haven't had a chance to look at those policies, but those were also brought up by the committee as something to consider.
Yeah, on the policy side of things, definitely.
Councillor Battelle?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was going to suggest that you say you do a campus-wide survey, but you already did that, so I'm curious to know what the response rate was. Like, were people interested in this at all, or was it just the groups that you would think would be interested in and respond to?
We haven't actually done the survey yet.
We haven't done the campus-wide survey.
We have the framework for it, and our plan was to roll it out in September, but we wanted to talk to council before. Mm-hmm.
That would be my suggestion.
Councillor Chamoy?
In terms of consultations, I think another group to consult with would be faculty associations, just to have their input as well. It helps us, too, because our faculties are in favor of it, that just counselors can help vote that way, too, just have some unity.
Thank you. Councillor Speakman?
With regard to new buildings on campus, maybe get one in top.
Yeah, they're not happening. They really tried.
One of our committee members took a lot of energy and hours into that, and it's not happening. Yeah. Good suggestion, though.
Councillor Hodgson?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just to reiterate a couple of things, I think the campus-wide survey would be a great way to do the consultation, but I think it'd be important just to target a few key groups as well. Another one maybe being international students. Just some key groups, like religious groups, international students, as well as a smattering of other student groups in there. It's hard to give examples, but like I just see from your list, it's a lot of groups that are based out of South, which is important because that's we're spending a lot of time there. But I think it's important to reach out to groups around campus as well. But the campus-wide survey is a great way to do that as well.
Councillor Binchik.
Have you already discussed all the methods of consultation with all the universities that already have the gender washrooms?
Like what methods they took?
Yes.
Most of them did a survey. Not all of them had to do a survey, but like University of Victoria, like we have their survey that they did. Most of them had to do some sort of survey. I think a couple had done focus groups as well.
Mm-hmm. With that, we have reached our 30-minute limit. That being said, I suspect that our presenters would be happy to hear additional feedback from you via email or any other mediums. So I'm not sure if your contact information is in the presentation document. If not, yeah, you're welcome to write it on there, or I'm sure you can email Nicole and she can get it to you, or I'm sure any of the executive members as well probably have it so they can get that information to you as well. So with that, I'd like to thank our presenters. Moving on, item 2B, law student tuition, presented by Scott Meyer from the Law Students Association, sponsored by Vice President Challen. Is there a second? Is that seconding? Seconded by President Kuzmu. Is there any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, the presentation will proceed as planned. A couple seconds to set up. Do you have any sort of PowerPoint? There's a report just on the side of the monitor. Just right here, actually. It's marked beautifully. Most people miss it, so. Sure. That'd be nice. Bless your haircut. If you're having trouble, there's another one in the closet here. It's like that's the main. Yeah, here. If you just open that door, that's. We're ready to start. So again, just a reminder to the presenters, you have 30 minutes including questions.
Cool. Hey. So up with me are Adil and Scott, the President and Vice President External of the Law Students Association. They wanted to talk a little bit more about their advocacy efforts. For those of you that don't know, faculty associations are these student groups that represent students within a faculty. Each of you, with the exception of Open Place, are members of faculty associations. They have excellent ones. I work the most closely with them. Law Students Association, official faculty association for law students. And so they wanted to introduce their advocacy efforts, talk in particular about the budget issues that they're facing, tuition issues that they're facing, because council does play an important role in sort of the broad oversight and collaboration with faculty associations. So, Scott, Adil?
Okay. So Adil is just going to be taking down after like any of your questions and concerns. I think he'll also be answering some questions as well.
I really wanted to at least want to talk in this talk.
So I'm Scott Meyer. Some of you may know me from my work working with William Lau. I'm also known as the transit buying guy. Really hoping my law degree pays off for more than that. But. All right, so this is our presentation on law students' concern. So general overview. So we're going to talk about general issues facing law students across the country, so general market pressures. And then we're going to get into enrollment, tuition, and job prospects. As a result of the budget cuts that we've been seeing, and the fact that faculties and their respective deans are being asked to consider potential ways of making more revenue, our faculty is considering increasing enrollment from 175 to 200 per year. And then overall, through the 3 years of law school, that would go from 525 to 600 students. So we're talking about differential tuition, and how this all applies to students' job prospects. And we're also going to talk about law student concerns, and then where we go from here. So just a couple of quick definitions. So a common law degree, as we received here at the University of Alberta, and most provincial jurisdictions outside of Quebec, and one school in New Brunswick, and one school in Ottawa. So that's like the descendant of British colonial law. So it's an accredited degree which allows individuals to practice laws in jurisdictions with common law and legal system. So a civil law degree, a BCL, is predominantly offered in Quebec, and there's a school, Moncton, in New Brunswick, and then the common, the
Faculty of Law at Ottawa also offers a civil law degree. So, articling. So, how a law degree works is you do 3 years of your work on campus, and then you have to do another year at a firm. So, like, it varies depending on the province how long that articling year is, but it's basically a paid internship, and then you have to do it before you can take the bar exam to become a member of your province's law society. And this one I'm sure you're all aware of, especially with the international law students tuition discussion coming up, differential tuition. So this is additional fees on top of the base tuition that the average undergraduate student is charged. And then, of course, the law program is a differential tuition program. So general things that are affecting law students across the country. Here's compensation based on your year of call. So this is students fresh out of the profession in the year 2012, after they've done their articling year. That's the rates of compensation. And then, so this is students that have now been out of, or have been at the bar for 6 years. So as you can see, the compensation scale is pretty good. And so that's the number one thing. So students accrue a lot of debt going into law school, because first they have the debts from their undergraduate degree, and then they have the debts from their further law degree, which again is subject to those differential tuitions. So for most law students, the key is getting into the legal profession to pay off those higher student debts. So general issues facing law students across the country continue. So over the years, we've seen an increasing market saturation. So more and more lawyers are being admitted to the bar. And that's part of law schools are increasing enrollment rates across the country. So as you can see here, from the year 2000 to the year 2010, we've seen from per lawyer, per Canadian citizen, is 449 Canadian citizens in 2000, and now we're up all the way up to 396. So to put that in perspective, the current ratio in the United States is 1 for every 256. Now, I know what you're saying, like, oh, we seem to be doing a lot better than them. Well, they're doing pretty rough. So a lot of law students are being left out. As you can see here, we've got $120,000 of debt, and they have no job in the legal profession to pay that off. So now a lot of them are suing their alma maters because they believe they were tricked into going to law school and paying all this money, even though the employment prospects weren't there. So that 1 in 256 isn't exactly the best number to shoot for.
And they have nothing to do now, so they need to sue somebody.
Yeah, like, so they were trained well. They can be lawyers, just no one's hiring them. So, like, what does it look like in Canada? So there's an articling crisis right now in Ontario. So currently, in 2008, only 6% of students couldn't find an articling position. In 2012, that number jumped all the way up to 12.1% students graduating with a law degree from Ontario couldn't find an articling placement. In 2013, that 12% jumped back up to 15.5%. That's a massive number. So a lot of people attribute this, as you can see here, between 2001 and 2011, the faculties in Ontario increased their enrollment numbers by 15.5%. So there's definitely a distinct correlation there. So, like, they are calling it an articling crisis. Even the Law Society of Upper Canada, that's the accrediting organization.
Basically in Upper Canada?
Oh, yeah. I was like, this is my presentation. I worked really hard on that. But yeah, they still call it Upper Canada. So the Law Society of Upper Canada is proposing a 3-year pilot project. So in addition to the 10-month articling program, they're offering a new way that people can get accredited at the bar. So basically, it's a 4-month course and then a 4-month, I believe it's a volunteer placement at this point. It's still a pilot project to be initiated. So a lot of provinces are looking at it with a lot of curiosity to see if it'll work. So why are we talking about the articling crisis in Ontario? Well, over the last couple of years, as a result of both the federal and the provincial governments putting a lot of pressure on the law societies, because they want to see the ability for the all professions to be mobile on a national scale. So from 2002 to 2012, they basically, like, they've eliminated a lot of the regulations and a lot of the stipulations that the law societies originally had. Before, it was very tough. If you were approved or accredited at the bar in Ontario, it was very difficult to pick up practice and come to Alberta. Well, what the Federation of Law Societies of Canada has done is they passed a series of agreements and making it slowly bigger and bigger, so that's no longer a big worry. In fact, as of right now, a lawyer in Ontario
even without being accredited at the bar in Alberta, can practice 100 days in Alberta. So it's like the lawyer profession is more mobile than it's ever been. So when you take this national mobility and you take it in context with the articling crisis in Ontario, we're increasingly worried about disenchanted law students from the Ontario school system coming and like soaking up more of the Alberta jobs. So as it currently stands, you'll see we have pretty good ratios in Alberta. We actually have a really good placement scenario for University of Alberta graduates. So these numbers come from the Faculty of Law Career Services. So as you can see here in 23, only about 6% of those students weren't finding articling placements. So not a bad number. So we're gonna we'll go back to this one. So the big worry that we have is if we start to increase enrollment numbers in Alberta, in say both Calgary and Alberta, and then other schools across Canada start to increase those enrollment numbers, instead of having an articling crisis in Ontario, we're going to have an articling crisis nationwide. So just to give you an idea of like how enrollment and tuition come together, we're just going to break down the fees for you. So currently the law faculty charges a $50 fee. This is part of the Bylaw 8400 series for faculty associations. That $50 goes towards supporting the faculty's career services department. So tuition undergraduate, this is going to be the same for a lot of you who have five course load. So it's $2,634 semester, and then the differential fee for the LLB, but we're actually a JD program now. So the differential fee on top of that per semester is $2,250. So specific costs. So we're further breaking down the costs. So what you'll see, including all your general fees, so the total cost of first-year law is about $11,500. Total cost of second and third-year law is $11,200. The reason why second and third-year law is a little less expensive is because there's fewer courses. They really pack in a fine, awesome course load in first year. So you can see those discrepancies between the total costs of courses. So this is the total tuition cost. So that's once you remove the student's union and the health plan and the other costs. So this is what we're paying for raw tuition. So now that we're going to tie it all together. So we have been increasingly considering going for an increase in the differential tuition rate that is currently being charged to law students. So three things you need to know about our inquiries into this. This is not entirely a reaction to the March 7th budget cuts. In the 2009-2010 school year, we asked for an increase in the differential tuition. We were above. In 2010-2011, we asked for an increase in the differential tuition. We were above. So this is actually our third time at the chopping block. But the budget cuts certainly exacerbate that, especially when they force the faculties to start considering enrollment increases. So the second thing you need to know, the faculty is not driving for a differential tuition rate. They were actually set in the last year to increase their enrollment rate from 175 to 200. But based on their consultations with the DEAL and other of their significant stakeholders, they decided to hold off on that for a year. So this is entirely a consultation process that's being driven right now by law students and not the faculty. Although we will say the faculty has been very forthcoming with their financial numbers in regards to like how they're spending their money. So number three, this is not an endorsement of an increase in other students' tuition rates. We are not advocating for an increase in international students' tuition rates. We are not advocating for an increase in medical students' differential tuition rates. This is isolated just to law students' concerns. Seems kind of axiomatic, like the law students not advocating, but a lot of people think that we're trying to open this up for everyone. That's not the case at all. We believe every faculty has their own concerns that they need to address. So other student concerns that especially we start to see since the budget cuts on March 7th. So again, the increased class sizes, if we do go to 525 to 600 and then 175 to 200 per class year. So we believe an increase in enrollment, it'll lead to a diminished availability of professors. Because again, there's not that much new money coming in. Because right now, the Alberta government is only providing a base operating grant for those 175 students per year. So then 25 additional students would be funded just for tuition. So what's going to happen is you're going to have larger class sizes, which can lead to diminished availability of professors. And as well, we actually have one of the smaller career services departments in the country, which is key when you're trying to find those articling placements, is to have a vibrant articling. So if you already have now 75 more students, that strained career services department is only going to be strained even further. So reduction in professors. So in order to grow the Faculty of Law's prestige, you need new professors. You need new associates. That's how you rejuvenate your program. That's how you rejuvenate the morale, and that's how you bring new ideas into the institution, which can only increase its significance on the national scene. As well, we don't believe the surrendering of professor positions is a good idea. Because as it stands right now, it is very difficult to get into some courses. Our enrollment date is typically at 7 o'clock in the morning. Most students will have 3 laptops open, all of them open on bare tracks, trying to get into those 10 classes. Typically, you will get into 7 of the 10 classes you want. Some students will take a degree and they will never, ever, even though we offer the course, get into a class they want, just because right now there already is fewer professors offering those courses. So we're already pretty strained in that department. So again, if the faculty starts surrendering faculty positions, we're also going to have a reduction in course offerings. So that raises a whole host of other questions. Are they going to start making it more strictly substantive law courses? Are we going to see the reduction in smaller class sizes where, that is really where the legal profession can be crafted? Because the smaller class sizes lend to greater debate, and that is what the legal profession is. So right now, as a result of the central administration's cut for the 2012-2013 year, they've closed the library throughout the summer months. So originally we have, law is very unique. We need legal librarians to do some of our work, because there's a lot of case law out there, and the librarian can help you get to the case law that's relevant to your situation much quicker. But again, as a result of the 2012-2013 cuts, they decided to close the law library throughout the summer months. Now, this is kind of an embarrassing position, considering we're the only law school in Canada which doesn't offer library services during the summer months. And as well, proposals that also might result is a reduction in scholarships. So how have we engaged our student body so far? So on March 21st and 22nd, we had our faculty association elections. As you'll see, 60% of our student body voted for the current executive of the law students. So we've been given a very broad mandate. As well, we organized a town hall for our student body April 11th, and I believe Petros going on there that day? Maybe you?
No, unfortunately.
Oh, that's
I wanted to be there.
Fulton was there. No, I got Fulton. Basically, we had a town law to discuss what law students felt in regards to possibility of enrollment increases, possibility of tuition increases. And I think even Petros can say probably 80% of our student body would prefer to see a tuition increase over an enrollment increase. That's just an anecdotal number, but that's based on the conversations I've had with a number of students. So as well, we reached out to numerous stakeholders in the legal community. Again, a lot of alumni donate quite extensively to the Faculty of Law, so they have a stake in this as well. And in addition, we've engaged in substantive talks with the faculty administration. And again, they've been very forthcoming. I don't know how other faculties are dealing with their deans, but our dean has been really giving us, as far as I understand, unprecedented access to how their financial systems are working. So where to now? If we do decide to explore differential tuition, I figured I'd just break down the differential tuition that law students are facing. It's known as a 60-20-20 split. Some people call it a 60-40, but I like the 60-20-20. So 60% of the revenue goes to the faculty for operating expenses, 20% of the revenue goes to student support, scholarships, bursaries, and then 20% goes to the central administration. We believe if we move forward with a differential tuition increase, that bottom 20% will be the biggest issue for everyone involved. Because the reason why, or a big reason why, the government said they instituted these cuts was to go after that central administration fat and the bloated contracts they have there. Now, some people could also argue about that 60%, but we believe the 20% that's most up for debate is that bottom one. So, Post-Secondary Learning Act. So, if we did want to pursue a differential tuition increase, the first stop we have to make is to you guys. So Section 7 of Bylaw 8100 says that if a student body ever wants to contradict students' union political policy, we first have to get a resolution from the Students' Council. So as you see here, I've also included students' union political policy. Students' union will not support the Board of Governors for the University of Alberta increasing tuition. So that's why we have to first get a resolution from you guys. If we did get that resolution passed, the Post-Secondary Learning Act says the next step is to go through the regulations. And an increase in program tuition has to first be approved by the Minister of Enterprise and Advanced Education. So let's take a look at the regulations. So market modifier for tuition fees for specific programs. So I've highlighted the important part. A board of an institution may request in writing, in a form, and at times, determined by the minister, that the minister approve an increase in tuition fees in respect of a specific program of study. So there it is. That's the minister has to sign off on a differential tuition increase. So differential tuition increase is not our only avenue of relief. We can also go through the same $50 fee that you see on our transcripts through the Bylaw 8400A series. So this is a student's union bylaw. So there would be, as far as I understand, no Board of Governor oversight on this. But again, so this would be, I haven't taken a look at what is required for Student Council to ratify this. But as far as I understand, I would like, so you pass it or you don't pass it, but if you do pass it, say for X dollars, then a committee is formed to oversee that money to make sure that it's going towards a very specific purpose. And there's a number of purposes located in the Bylaw 8400 series of how that money can be spent by the faculty. So it does constrain what they can do with that money. So this is the third option. Not a great option, but that's kind of what we're doing right now as it is. Thought that'd get more laughter, but okay. So which option do we choose? We can continue to engage relevant stakeholders from the legal community. We're also in talks right now with Kevin Stenner, who's the president of the Student Legal Society of Calgary. And we're talking, because if we do all this work to try and prevent an enrollment increase, it would be all for naught if Calgary says, okay, we're able to do the 25-person enrollment increase. So we're in frequent consultations with him, and as well finding out, seeing if we can get an idea of what their provincial base grant is for how much their law faculty is receiving compared to how much our law faculty is receiving, to see if, like, because, like, one, there's been a variety of options that have been thrown around for numbers for how much a tuition increase should be, but we want to know what are the exact numbers that different institutions are seeing. And unfortunately, that's not publicly available, so we have to do this through consultation. So we can also do another possible town hall to further engage our student body on what they feel our next best move is. We can get a formal proposal from the faculty, and this is something we will have to do before we will possibly even advocate for a tuition increase, but how the money will be spent. So we would like to see a number of contingencies, again, if we go that direction. And then before we come back to Students' Council, we would want to do probably a plebiscite to get a better understanding, again, of what our student body wants to do, make sure we're doing adequate consultation. And again, the last one, come back to Student Council with Law Students' final decision.
Questions?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so we have about 10 minutes for questions. Council Mohammed?
So the Minister of Advanced Education and Enterprise, he went out and said that the graduates were frozen. The faculty of law, like, they're still undergrads. So wouldn't it put us in a difficult political position if a group of students were to go up to him and ask for a tuition raise? Like, it's not that much of a stretch for him to reason that if students are asking for a tuition raise, then why not just unfreeze tuition? Because he has done some crazy things, so I wouldn't rule that out. So, how are you guys going to address those concerns? And also, what's the timeline for coming back to council?
Well, that, like, it's going to depend on when we can get a plebiscite done, because we don't want to come back to student council until we've had a strong voice from our student body making a decision on the issue. But again, and you are right, the minister could make that decision, but I would also say it's highly unlikely based on the current political calculus, especially with the promises they made in the 2012 election. Like, granted, those promises weren't necessarily upheld. But I do hear what you're saying, but I feel like if the student union can still say, we are against tuition increases across the board and make exceptions. Governments do it all the time. Like, I don't think us going to the enterprise or the minister, he would say, okay, so like the law students want an increase in tuition, and everybody wants an increase in tuition. Again, like, it's politics, but I don't think it's in the political calculus form.
It's also a bit of a unique situation, I would say, because, I mean, when was the last time a bunch of students have said, raise our tuition, please? I mean, it just doesn't, it doesn't happen. I've been in school for a long time. We can inspire people to want more tuition. I think it's a relatively unique situation. So there should be a little bit less, your fears for, the reprisals on the rest of the faculty sort of jumping on that bandwagon should be quelled a little bit because it's a unique situation. And I think it's also important to understand that this isn't a reaction just to the recent stuff that's been going on with the minister and the PCs and, you know, all the recent decision on the budget cuts and all that. It's been exacerbated by that. But we've been trying this for about 5-6 years now because our tuition is pretty low, right, compared to the rest of Canada. Our tuition is pretty low, and we're not getting quality back. It needs to go up.
Yeah. I will say, just to address your question, this is the statutory framework right now under the regulation. So this is for tuition fees for specific programs. So if we ask for relief from this regulation, it's for these programs that already have the differential tuition. So they would have to go into other parts of the Post-Secondary Act. Like, and to be fair, like, if the minister was, like, if all it took was law students advocating for a tuition increase, for him to, like, open it up to the entire board, they would have been planning it the entire time.
Okay, Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the presentation. Just two quick points.
One quick point.
Just from what you said, it sounds like you're feeling or leaning more strongly towards doing a plebiscite or something. I would like, in order, because this would have to come before council to approve to advocate contrary to SU political policy, I would never vote in favor of that without like a plebiscite from law students. So.
And we would never bring it without a plebiscite. Yeah. Like I think the reason why we do have 60% voter turnout is because they do trust us. And yeah, something as big as this, we would never do without a plebiscite. Absolutely. But I share your sentiment.
Thank you. Councillor Battelle.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm really confused as to why it's one or the other of these two options that you presented, because I feel like it's an unfair extrapolation that you made in terms of higher enrollment means less jobs for the students that are graduating. How does the articling work? I mean, do you have to compete for these spots, then compete at a larger number? I mean, you're going to compete anyways. It doesn't, like, I don't understand why it's one or the other. It seems very unfair to people that would want to get in. Like, it's a double slap in the face. Like, some people would have to pay more and at the same time compete even harder to get in.
Well, okay. One of the issues is it's not necessarily a dichotomy. It might be presented that way, and it might seem that way to you guys, but the faculty is going one way. This is an enrollment increase is the way to go. We had to stop from doing that. We held a town hall meeting. We got a consensus from people. We went to the dean and said, no, you can't do the enrollment increase. It's just going to screw us over. And they held off for a year. They're going to do it next year unless, I mean, it's really on us now. If you have something else that you think would work, go for it. But the faculty is not doing this. Like, they have... They might not feel... Well, no, it's just they've done it before. It didn't work. They have to find other avenues. They have to find other avenues to make up the money. And that's the situation they're in, and that's the way they were going until we stepped in and said, no, this is pretty bad for us. And your second point was, are you really competing? Like, you just have to compete harder. I believe if there's
limited spots for articling.
But the thing is by you're by adding more people competing for those spots, there's going to be more people without jobs. Like, it's just the way the market works. The market hasn't expanded. It's just the market's staying the same, but you're just adding more people applying for jobs, which is really pointless.
Okay. Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll preface this by saying that I am personally against you guys' position. With that being said, you can bring an overwhelming plebiscite, and understood. That's your constituents telling you what to do. My biggest thing here is more of a concern that that you guys are more than welcome to address, but it's a concern in the general room. I think that raising tuition in any faculty sets a precedent. It is my job and the rest of the executive's job as VP external, as president, as VP academic, to go into the room at the university and explain to them why tuition going up is a bad thing and why they shouldn't do that and why it's hurting students. But when one faculty moves forward to increase their tuition, all we're going to hear about is that faculty. And, oh, law did it, and law did it, and the law students are clearly smart because they're raising their tuition, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to hear the same from the government. And it's going to be used as that kind of precedent for why tuition should be increased. And it's also going to attack our political policies, where we state that tuition shouldn't, we shouldn't vote in favor of tuition going up, but we're going to get, you know, called out on, sort of looking for here, quashing our students' voice, because clearly they want their tuition to go up. So that is my primary concern, and obviously that's kind of a stab at you guys. If you guys want to address that, I'd be more than happy.
Basically, I totally understand the position that you guys are in. I totally get it. I would feel the same myself here, in your shoes. The only problem, though, is, I hate to go back to like a unique situation, but essentially we are in a spot now where our tuition and our program is undervalued, significantly undervalued, and it has been for about 5 years. And I mean, the reality of, you know, economics and the marketplace, and you know how that's like how, you know, economic forces dictate the price of the tuition, is that it should be higher. It should be higher. It can't just stay where it is right now because the government feels that, you know, it's a nice thing to say that there shall be no tuition hikes. If we need a tuition hike, if we want a tuition hike, we need to be given that the availability to improve our program. Do you know what I mean? Like, we need that ability. And I totally understand, you know, whatever the concerns that you guys have. I get that. It makes sense on, you know, on the political stage, and you know, the policies that the SU has to stay strong to. But I mean, we're sort of, you know, we're bashing our heads against the wall at this point. Like,
I will just say, like, just to give you like the benchmark right now, Toronto is right now, their tuition per year is $31,000.
That's the university's favorite talking point.
Yeah. And again, like, it's not always the best talking point, because again, we don't know how much provincial operating grants are. But it's the only benchmarks we have. Right now, we're the fifth cheapest common law jurisdiction. And again, law is a unique beast, because our professors cost quite a significant amount more. Because these people coming to work in academia, they could probably make 4 to 5 times more in private practice. And again, like, I agree completely with what you guys are saying, and like, you guys are representing your constituents by saying that. But this is something that has overwhelmingly been coming from our constituents as well. I think the fact like we had 60% voter turnout,
and this was a big issue.
This is a big issue. I think, like, I don't know how many other faculty associations get 60% voter turnout. Like, what was federal election?
And we don't usually get 60%.
Yeah. What was the last federal election? What, like 59%? Like, students, like law students, are very passionate about this.
Okay. Thank you. Unfortunately, we have hit our 30-minute mark, so we will have to end this presentation. Council Mohammed?
Can we just do a motion to extend?
We can do a motion to extend.
I just wanted to say thanks for listening to us. Yeah. Those are some very valid concerns, so we'll take it back to our...
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion to extend. Do you want to set a time extension?
15 minutes.
Motion to extend to 15 minutes. Seconded by Councillor Binchik. Requires 2/3 majority vote. All those in favor? Any opposed?
I had Gossip Girl.
Cool. Okay. That motion is carried. So we are going until 7:58. Councillor Binchik.
Yeah. thank you. I'm wondering, how will you advocate for students who do meet the admission requirements, however, would be unable to pay for increased tuition because the scholarship, from my understanding, the pound would not be increasing?
Well, okay, what's happening now is some of the scholarships and bursaries and those sort of things that that are sort of targeted for, you know, students who can't afford, you know, the exorbitant tuition fees already, they're being cut back. They're being scaled back because they're trying to make avenue for money. The law faculty knows that they need to cut costs and they need to find money elsewhere. So a lot of the scholarships and bursaries are, and this is probably for most faculties as well, they're worded in a certain way where it doesn't, like, the bursary doesn't necessarily have to go to a student. It can go to support services, or it can go to something else. Like, it's very broad. So the faculty is now taking a more broader look, and the average student is getting less, is going to get less of those bursaries. If we can do the tuition increase, then we can keep that. And one of the things I will ask for is to keep the bursaries amount the same. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I will just say two quick things on that. Like, that 60-20-20 split, so if a tuition increase, and we are not looking for like a sizable tuition increase, we're preferring to call it a tune-up. That, of that differential tuition increase, it's a 60-20-20 split. So if a tuition increase does come, 20% of that will be towards student supports, whether that be bursaries or scholarships. And also, too, the faculty would not have to be forced to take up that scholarship money with the looser wording and move it into other student support services. So, and that's one thing. Like, that's the number one thing that we have been looking at as a struggle with differential tuition is, yeah, students who might not otherwise be able to afford it. And that's a huge diversity issue. And that's one thing, the biggest thing we're looking at is diversity. And any proposal we make for differential tuition increase, well, we want that diversity maintained, and especially for lower-income students.
Thank you, Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Trigan. Thank you for the presentation. Could you go back to the slide of the 60-20-20 split?
I would like to say I tried to keep it general, so you're about to, like, tear it apart.
Oh, no.
Okay, it's right then.
So this is your proposal. Is this what you're suggesting, or is this something that already exists, just from my understanding?
Right now, this is the law faculty's current differential, the 60-20-20.
Okay, fair enough. So should an increase in fees go through, this should be the distribution of the fees. Okay.
And we would also have specific demands.
Okay. And the faculty of law doesn't want to see a 60-40. They want a 60-20-20.
Right. Oh, fair enough. Okay. That makes a lot more sense, because initially I was very concerned that, I mean, one of the problems I think that student associations, students across Canada have been having is we're seeing these increases in tuition fees and all other sorts of kinds of fees, but no corresponding increase in services that are coming. So I guess, do you have any information on how effective this guideline, like, do you have proof that this is being enforced by the university? Because some of what I've been hearing from folks in the student union and some of the policy advisors is that, again, we are seeing these increases in fees, but not any corresponding increase in services. So my hesitation would be, fair enough, let me say, I sympathize completely with your plight, increasing class sizes, decreasing services, your library being closed, I mean, it's outrageous. I have unlimited empathy for your situation, but unless we can, I think, get a guarantee that this increase in fee will directly equate to an increase in services, I'd be really hesitant to vote in favor. I mean, and that's completely besides my personal inclination to argue that we should be arguing in favor of more stable provincial funding. We should be arguing that the province actually fund our universities so that we don't have to be constantly making post-secondary education more and more inaccessible. But I'm not, it's not my job to tell you what to do, to advocate for, right? So, just things to keep in mind. If you could give me that evidence showing that this is how it will go, that would be great. And then maybe later we can talk about, well, should we do this in first place?
No, that's a damn good point. Because basically how we're treating this meeting or this presentation is to get a feel for how you guys feel about it. And what your concerns are, and we want to address them. So that's actually something that when we come back to you guys, we will have.
Great, thank you.
Councillor Schiavone?
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to second some of the concerns so far, like in terms of the tuition increase going across the board. I don't see it so much affecting faculties like arts. I really don't see CBAS advocating in favor of tuition increase. I'd be more concerned with faculties like med or dentistry, because I would assume they're facing similar issues, perhaps not for the same amount of time as you guys have, but I would assume that they're facing similar issues since they do have small enrollment. It'd be more interesting to see what their faculty associations are saying, too, in terms of if this does go through. And again, we probably don't want to have 3, 4, 5 faculty associations coming back to us and saying, oh, we want a tuition increase, too. Because if we're advocating on behalf of that many tuition increases, then, as Vice President Wood was saying, it's really going against our policies. It's really going against what we're supposed to be advocating for as a student.
And yeah, like that's why we're going through like this consultation process, is because we do really value your guys' opinion. And to be honest, like in the past, the Law Students Association hasn't been this deferential to the different student voices, and we definitely want to open this up and be collaborative, because it's a tough situation. Like at the end of the day, I don't think anyone, we don't like standing here being like, yeah, tuition increase.
I'm loving it.
it's not our favorite thing to do. So like, yeah, that's it. Like any policy decision is going to be both sides. But
yeah, no, that's yeah, like, that's something we'll get back to you on as well. And that's a pretty good point. But I know that med tuition is higher. I don't know how much higher. I don't know whether they're, like you said, like, are they going through similar concerns? So actually, we'll find that out.
As far as I understand, though, they get a higher base operating government grant from the province, which is not all unexpected. Like, we read books, they use surgical units, which are significantly more pricey than staff.
Thank you. Councillor Speakman?
Yeah, thanks. I think another thing you could do to better your case for council here is a plebiscite not only of your current students, but of potential students. And I think that as the law faculty, where students come in after second or third year or something like that, you guys have like a unique position to actually get some support or not from incoming law students too.
It's an interesting idea. I just I don't know. I don't even know how do you find
potential. I don't know how you would do that.
It's a cool idea.
Yeah,
because they're the ones who are going to be affected. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
It's hard to take, because it's the same thing for us. Like, we're going to have an opinion, but like if you were to ask a potential incoming student, like, do you think they should have more spots available for you to get in? Like, they're going to be clearly. But the thing is, like, no law student comes into law school like wishing, oh, I hope you get high tuition. It's once you've been punched in the gut and when you've been knocked down, you've gone on like 30 interviews and haven't got a single job, that's when you start to be like, this is a really tough environment. And that's in Alberta, where there's a 6% unemployment number. I can't even begin to imagine what it's like in Ontario when it's 15% and you're sitting there on top of $60,000. So, I really do, because at the end of the day, this is going to affect incoming students, but also, too, like, just the thing we want you guys to consider is just, like, once you've pulled your hair out, you've been so stressed about finding a job because you're looking at your mounting debt and you don't have a job that can, like, pay it back. So, like we've noted that, but, like, that's just, like, kind of the thing that, like, we consider as well.
I don't know if this addresses your concern, but one of the things that we're also putting forth is that it's not grandfathered in. So current students are voting on their own tuitions being increased next year. I think that addresses it slightly, because then we're getting the views from people who are affected. Not, I mean, if we were all grandfathered in, then raise your hand. I don't know, right? So, I mean, a little bit of that we're trying to deal with by, you know, having a good faith gesture by not having a grandfather.
But the one thing I'll also say about grandfathering, it's also really tough in this political atmosphere. The provincial government is going to say, listen, we're trying to cut that back, and you guys are just throwing more cash at the problem. Like, let us cut that back before we think about throwing more cash at this institution. I'm not being argumentative here. I'm just saying like these are just all the different balls that we're trying to juggle right now.
Thank you, President Kuzma.
So yeah, I want to be one of the first individuals to say thanks for presenting to us and having the courage to come to our council and being really open and honest with us. I mean, you folks don't see it, but the LSA has been in constant communication with us and they're super nice and they bring Timbits for meetings and stuff.
You got mad at me for bringing Timbits. You're like, are you trying to get me fat, man?
That's concerned. But overall, they've been super friendly. Again, thanks a lot for the presentation. And you, Adele, you kind of touched on one of the points I wanted to raise. When I went to the town hall meeting last year, where there was like myself, I think we had some other SC folks and like 22 other law students. One of the other issues that was raised was the grandfathering of like fairness, and I think that's a really good point. I don't necessarily think it's a fair thing for you to vote on a decision where the consequences doesn't impact you, and it's nice to see that the LSA is in favor of that. And for those of you folks who don't know what grandfathering means, it essentially says, oh, you vote on tuition increases, but you won't get the tuition increases. There'll be folks after you. So it's a good thing that they're not in favor of grandfathering. Because that means the decision that you make, you know, there's consequences that you face it. So. But with that being said, I think another interesting thing for councilors to note is, is there a particular, and just a question, would a 50% plebiscite make you happy? Would it be more than that, or et cetera? This does follow our bylaws, right? Like, the faculty associations do have the ability to go through this process, so it's not like this is an anomaly, but this does exist. You can just make sure you have some of these. If you have these expectations, please tell us the LSA at that time so they can try to fill it during the presentation period.
Thank you. Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for the presentation.
Thanks for the beep.
So what level of certainty do you have that if differential tuition were to be passed, that it would go to the student support and the scholarship bursaries and libraries?
So that's part of our discussions with the dean. He knows that if... Because basically, I mean, the relationship we have with the dean at this point is basically, so how are things going? And we tell him how things are going and the ideas we have. And he's like, okay. He's not really involved. Like, if we speak to the minister, when we come and talk to you guys, like, he's not involved in this. Like, it's you guys. If you guys want to do this, it's your call. Part of the discussions that I've had with him, I've outlined that we will have demands. If we get this, we will have demands. And part of it will be, enforcement of the split and a lot more specific stuff too, because you might not know this, you might know it, but we have what's called moot competitions in law, and they're very, very prestigious in the legal community. Extremely prestigious. And this year we ripped it. But that depends on professors and, the amount of time they can spend on extracurricular activities and that sort of stuff. And that'll be one of the things that we demand for. It's like, we don't want any fun. We want more funding actually put into the MOOC programs because we're so good at it, and it makes our school look good. So, I mean, that's sort of one of the things. Enforcement of the split will be another. And then, the library. We have a bunch of demands. We're just needy people.
And what's going to stop?
I'm going to, cut you off there. We've got a fairly long list, so do you want to go back on the list? I will be on the list. Councillor Gruelke?
Thanks again for coming. But I don't know if I just missed it, but did you ever say what type of increase you're looking for?
Actually, no, we didn't. It would be, because we're not exactly sure.
Okay.
But a rough number, we will have the specific for you, of course, when we'll have the specifics when we take it to our students and have them on the vote on the plebiscite. But a rough number as it looks now is 1,500 over 2 years. So 750 something.
Thank you. With that, we have unfortunately reached our time again. Councillor Mohammed?
Yes.
How many people are on the
6.
You guys love us.
Motion to extend by 10 minutes. Councillor Schiavone seconds. Not debatable, not amendable. Requires 2/3 majority. All those in favor? All those opposed?
Smoker?
Okay. Let's do that once more. Just sorry. All those in favor? All those opposed? Give me one sec. Okay. Sorry, once more, now that I know these guys. All those in favor?
I feel like we're losing votes.
Up, down, up, down, up, down.
Gotta get my email, by the way. Perfect. Talk to you about anything.
All those opposed? How's my math?
With the split.
It's 12 to 8. How's my math for 2/3?
That's 66.
No, that's 60. 60.
Okay, out of 20, yeah, that's 60. Unfortunately, that fails. That being
this
said...
This three first, people.
That being said, I'm sure, and I see he's already written his email address there, like our previous presenters. I'm sure our presenters here would be happy to continue having a conversation with you via email or any other medium you want. So with that, I would thank our presenters for their time.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Really.
Thank you.
Other, we were trying to call.
Apparently, I need to get better at my math. Thank you. With that, we will continue on with our agenda. I believe we have a nomination. Yes, we do. Item 7A. Greyhen moves that Students' Council appoint one member of Students' Council to Bylaw Committee. As Councillor Greyhen isn't here, is anyone else, preferably someone from Bylaw Committee, willing to... thank you, Councillor Hodgson. Do we have a seconder for that? Councillor Zhang, thank you very much. Councillor Hodgson, do you want to give a brief introduction?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, Bylaw Committee is the committee that reviews and amends and debates bylaws anytime. We have a few projects on the go right now, conflict of interest being the one coming tonight. We meet Monday nights at 6 p.m. Yeah, 6 p.m. Every other week. It's a lot of fun. Come hang out.
Any questions, procedural or whatnot, for Councillor Graham? Or, excuse me, not Councillor Graham, Councillor Hodgson. Seeing none, we will open the floor to nominations. Sorry, was that a question, President Kuzma?
No.
Okay, we will open the floor to nominations. Not all at once. Councillor Nguyen.
I'd like to nominate Councillor Speakman. I'm already on
ball. Councillor Speakman respectfully declines. Any further nominations? Councillor Speakman.
I nominate Councillor Grokey.
Councillor Grokey?
Respectfully declined.
Surprisingly respectfully declined. Any further nominations? Encouraging further nominations. Councillor Nguyen? Councillor Schiavone?
I would love to, but I have meetings every Monday at 6.
Okay. Encouraging nominations while discouraging random nominations like we got into last time. Governor Kelly?
I'd like to nominate Councillor
Council Mohammed. Moving on.
Point of information.
Yes, Councillor Grokey.
Who's bylaw chair?
Councillor Graham, but he's not here, so Councillor Hodgson could maybe answer.
Would Skype be considered a possibility?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah.
and to clarify, standing orders and bylaw dictates that Skype is acceptable at the discretion of the committee chair. So,
okay.
Councillor Schiavone.
I was informed that the meeting time might be being moved since many members of the committee are on Mondays. I accept the nomination again, if that's okay.
Okay, Councillor Schiavone accepts. Any further nominations?
No.
Councillor Vinchik?
I don't know if that's allowed, but
maybe Councillor Grokey would like to reconsider.
Councillor Grokey?
Every week?
Every other week, generally. Depends on business, but probably every other week.
Except.
Okay. Further nominations? Nothing on Skype. Give me 1 second here. I'm just going to mute the screen so that after speaking, the Skype people can vote without showing the world how they're voting. In fact, Skype people, feel free to send me a message independent of one another once we get to the voting stage if you want to keep it confidential. That would be awesome. So as we do, whenever we have a contested seat, I will allow 30 seconds to each individual. We will go in the order of nominations. Basically, just 30 seconds to explain why you want to be on the committee. Councillor Schiavone, you have 30 seconds.
Hi, Council. Thank you for the nomination. I want to be on Violet Committee, actually, but I didn't think I'd be able to do it due to the time of the meeting. I am interested in bylaws. I have helped a little bit with bylaws in my fraternity. I do think this room will be particularly interesting on bylaws, so that's why I'm interested in it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Councillor Grokey, you have 30 seconds. You would like to withdraw your nomination?
He's actually going to be there in person. And like,
it's your call.
I'll remove my nomination.
Okay. Councillor Grokey is withdrawing her nomination. As such, this is no longer contested. Congratulations to Councillor Schiavone. With that, we have now been in session for more than 90 minutes and dealt with one item of business, so we will have a 15-minute recess and convene at 20 after 8. Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to call this meeting back to order. We still have lots to go through, so we're going to try and get going on time here. We are now on executive committee reports. Are there any executives that care to report?
Yes.
Vice President Chong?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Council, the one thing that I would like to let you know of is that today was the official launch of the SCC bookstore campaign. For those of you that haven't been to the Students' Union building, you'll notice that it's inundated with advertisements encouraging students to consider alternatives to buying their textbooks new. Things like trying e-books, used books, online material, open source material, etc. So this is a campaign that my portfolio is running and with an attempt to get students to not buy new textbooks. 88% of students don't think textbooks are reasonably priced. Students are expected to spend about $12,000 or $1,200 a year on it, so hopefully we can make a dent on what students are being expected to spend. So just an update if you want to share it with your friends, particularly first year students that you might know. I think it'll be a great way to help save students money. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other execs? Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A couple of things that I'd like to direct Council's attention to. The first is regarding the municipal election. As I iterated in previous reports and at previous Council meetings, we will be getting an advanced polling station on campus for anybody, if you live in Edmonton, can vote. As I said, it'll be advanced polling, so not an election day, on the 17th on campus. The big thing with this, though, the big commitment we as the SU need to make is we need people to help run the polling station. They are looking for actually people to train and to have run the station on the 17th. They're looking for 7 volunteers. I'm looking at everybody in this room. It will pay you $120 for the day plus an additional $15 for training. Training will occur, I believe, on the 12th of October here at Sub. That's your birthday. Happy birthday, Chloe, on the 12th of October. So either way, they will train you, they will pay you, you'll be doing an extraordinary service to your Students' Union. This is a pilot project. They are not going to have, there's not going to be another polling station on campus again for a while. This doesn't go well. The one condition is that you must not be involved in any campaign in the election. You cannot have a lawn sign. You cannot be endorsing a candidate over social media. You cannot be working on a candidate's campaign. That's for both mayoral and council races. So, unfortunately, that is the one restriction. But if you're not involved in the election and you do want to help out, please come see me. I'll be making more advertisements for this later, but I wanted to approach council first, as well as faculty associations. The second thing is external advocacy team. It's certainly hit the point of September where I'd like to have the first lobby training conducted. I'd also like to start bringing more students to MLA meetings with me. Mike McGinn, our EPIO, has been coming with me up to this point. He's been great, but I'd also like more student involvement if possible. I'll be sending around a sign-up sheet during the meeting. If you're interested, please just put your name down. I'll be sending everybody an email really soon here with the first days of lobby training. And again, this is a really good opportunity, not only to help out with any campaign that SE runs this year, but also to, as I said, actually get that experience in advocacy and hopefully actually make it up to a few meetings. Lastly, just very briefly, I met with MLA Ken Lemke today of Stony Plain. It was a very good meeting. Agreed with the majority of our points, specifically surrounding instructional fees. So yeah, all is well. Please ask any questions if you have them.
President Kuzman.
Thanks, Council. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I hope all of you folks enjoyed my Council report. I had a lot in regards to the budget cuts. Two things that I'd like to add. First is in regards to the subway renovation project. I didn't include this in my report, but I actually spent quite a bit of time working with our general manager, Mark DeMichel, and the vice president of operations and finance, Josh Lake, on making sure that ATCO removed that gas pipeline at cost. So it didn't take, it was kind of weird. I was expecting it to be a little bit more dramatic, but it was really like a couple calls and emails, and after a lot of months of talks. So, but beyond that, the other thing I'd like to add is the fact that we've been reached out by the University Vice President of Finance and Administration to be able to present to our Students' Council. So what we're kind of thinking is perhaps we can maybe have an open Students' Council meeting at Substage on the second council meeting of September 24th, and have the Vice President's presentation be kind of like a mini town hall sorts where she can present to our council, but it would be public, very open, and a lot of students can attend, and after that we can resume and have our council meeting in public. I'll take it at the end. So that's kind of my proposal, like that's kind of what we're thinking about having, and CAC kind of has to make that decision, so hopefully we can get that approved. For those of you who are CAC, please get that CAC to approve that and secure that time. And the point of information, I can take it now.
Yeah, so maybe Mrs. Spoke, what did you say that
Vice President Biden? Oh, yeah, so she'll be presenting kind of like an update on the budget cuts, et cetera. And Vice President Academic Justin Challenge can talk more about it because I think he's going to do some direct correspondence with the Vice President. So, ask more questions about that council later or do you POI or
I would prefer questions during question period to POIs and reports.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, it's RFIs now, request for information. We've all got to get used to it. Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hello, Council. I have four major updates for you. The Daily Grind, our new coffee smoothie shop, is open. We're doing a soft launch. It opened last Tuesday, and it's been pretty successful. If you have any feedback, let us know. I personally recommend the Beanie's coffee. It's pretty good. The room at the top, our RAT, our campus bar, it's been under renovation over the past month or so, and it's going to be ready by Thursday-ish, about the end of the week. So it'll be through a soft launch. What happened is that there is we're equipping the kitchen with gas-powered equipment before it was very, very under resourced. So now it's going to be a lot better. So I have high hopes for RAP. Next piece, we're almost in the process of hiring operation managers for the bar. And the manager will go over the bars and duties and RAP. And the candidate is pretty promising. So there'll be another improvement to our food and beverage unit. And then the last piece, my President Lau and I met with Anastasia Lim, the Executive Director of University Relations, to talk about the long-range development plan and how the university uses land, space planning on campus. And there are going to be some amendments to the long-range development plan happening this fall. So you'll see a presentation sometime in late September, I believe. So be on the lookout for that.
Thank you, Vice President Lau.
speaker. So I'm going to repeat the first sentence of my council report because I really like it. It says, hello, council. School is right around the corner. Ah, I can smell the students in the air. Love it. Hashtag not creeped at all. Like, school is right around the corner. A few things I want to announce that are all taking place next week. First off, week of welcome. That starts next Wednesday and goes until Saturday, September 7th. I put up our week of welcome poster up on the whiteboard, as well as a poster for the movie night, which also lands on week of welcome, and it's next Wednesday on September 4th. I also handed out some presents around the room. One is, I guess they're both, it could be both used as bookmarks. One's a calendar of the week of welcome events. One is three movie pass for the movie night. And unfortunately, conflicting with the movie night on September 4th, we now have another initiative to bring forth that was talked about in CAP before council meeting today, and that is a barbecue at Augustana. So there's a barbecue at Augustana on September 4th, which is, again, the first day of school. They have a barbecue at about, I think it was 5:30 p.m.
We start cooking at 4. So.
Start cooking at 4. And that goes until, I believe, 5:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hockey game between the U of A Golden Bears and the Augustana Vikings at 6:30. With that, it was originally planned that exec would make a trip down to Augustana to visit the campus. But there has also been a request to bring a bus of students down. And if counselors are interested in this opportunity, we'd like to do a probably quick straw poll after council.
Thank you.
To see how many counselors are interested, and if we have, let's say, 20 names ready to go for the bus, then I would organize a funding allocation to get the bus going. And if any of you have questions, you can ask them in the question period. Last but not least, a quick reminder about council photos, if any of you haven't gotten your photos yet. If you get your photos before next Friday as sub photos, then we can work on our banner for my elections late September. Request for information.
I'm actually going to stop there, number one, because requests for information aren't really all that in order for reports unless they're really, really technical. But number two, Vice President Lau has actually exceeded his time. But with that, you can certainly ask a question during question period. We will move on to board and committee reports. Any committee chairs?
Am I allowed to ask a question about the report?
No, that would be in question period.
Great.
Yep.
Okay.
Any committee chairs wishing to make a report? Councillor Patel?
So, for policy committee, our meeting was supposed to be next Tuesday, our regular meeting time, and we canceled it so that we can all go as a committee to the president's address, Ellen Park. So, I will be emailing everybody to see if we want to muster somewhere and go as a group, but I just want to give you a heads up on that.
Thank you. Any other exec committee reports? Committee reports?
A brief one.
Sure, Vice President Lake.
For BFC, we had a brainstorm with the Budget and Finance Committee about ways to make the budget more engaging. And one of the fruitful ideas that came out that the senior manager of marketing is interested in is doing an infographic on the budget. And stay tuned over the year. We'll have something cool, pretty engaging. And if you have any feedback or any ideas around that, let me know.
Thank you. And we are... people are just chomping at the bit at question period. But, as you know, we'll move into question period. Written questions get priority, so I'm going to move to the first two there, but I will put both your names down. So, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Very much encouraging written questions. So, item 5A, Vice President Lau, if you have a response, you can certainly make it, and I will point to you as I get you on your list. So, Vice President Lau...
So 5A, what role will existing groups like ISMIS and the Gender Based Violence Prevention Project in the development of something like that huge potential diversity center of service? Well, so far in the process, ISMIS and the Gender Based Violence Prevention Project has played a minor role of sorts.
and they both have representation on the stakeholder committee. That gathers around to give input on what the service would look like. At this point, we don't have a clear idea of what the service would exactly be like for the program that it would align. So even as the service is created, it would maintain advisory or mentorship role. It'd be a strong partner on campus, and there would be areas where the service or the center would work a lot closer. For example, two examples would be Safe Spaces Initiative. Amazing skills like this initiative would be better housed in the service. Another example would be FindMeet, where it would feel that a service or a center would do a better job hosting and along that event.
Thank you. And on to item 5G, also to Vice President Lau, you're a popular guy.
Thanks. I didn't thought that way about welcome to the SU group. But why don't we amalgamate a week of welcome and orientation? I guess briefly, the divide between orientation and week of welcome is so that orientation is on the first day, and week of welcome starts on the Monday. Week of welcome isn't actually the whole week. And I guess the divide there is that orientation is academically driven, it's all the topics, how to navigate the university and such, and there's a sense with the students that go there that feel like, you know, there's information to, that's given. Perhaps that would feel as an optional week of welcome. Whereas week of welcome is it's entertainment focused, it's all that is optional, you can choose like what you're looking at. And it's really just a trick, but it's entertainment that's provided, so it's confused whether or not they go. Whereas orientation is more focused on contact with and educational activities.
Thank you. Moving on to oral questions. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Vice President Lay. I was curious, I'm actually checking, this would be pretty easy to check, but is Juicy still operating? But on that fact, I was under the impression the plan for the new coffee space, Daily Grind, was to incorporate both Cram Dunk and Juicy, and when I looked at it, they only have two or three smoothie options, so I didn't really see that as incorporating both businesses into one, so just curious about what happened there.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the question, Councillor Hodgson. The Juicy space is currently decan space for the sub-renovation, and in terms of the Juicy presence in the Daily Grind, and that's what we have space for, is if there is demand for more. But that was a decision from the senior manager of food and beverage. But we're open to suggestions if you feel that there's under utilization of it.
Thank you. Vice President Lau?
I have a question.
I thought you had a question. Did you just have your placard up to respond to the other question?
Mine was actually about, since our cat chair isn't here, I wanted to ask if we could give a quick update on something that was discussed.
Okay. Okay, we'll pause question period for a second because I know you're going with this. So yeah, you were at CAC, so if you want to give a quick 2-minute CAC or report, go right ahead.
I think the most important update I want to give from CAC is that the key message that we're planning to deliver between Discover Governance and CAC, I guess, is the what do you want from your university? And that's pretty much the pitch to students, to let them know that if they want something from the university, that Students' Council is a place to go to. Where advocacy happens and where they have a place to bring their voices. So I believe that's how CAC is, and Discover Governance will be approaching Clubs Fair this year. I believe Aaron sent out a doodle for everyone to sign for times. It's been going up really well. And I guess along with that, then, for Week of Welcome and Clubs Fair, that person will focus on Clubs Fair itself and other efforts that we've mentioned in the past will come out with.
Okay, thank you. We will resume question period. Councilor Mohammed.
Yeah, this question is directed to Mohammed. So the Deputy Premier Thomas has been appointed to financial advisors to the UA. I'm concerned about this since their salaries could fund professors. So I have... I'm concerned because their salaries could fund professors instead of, you know, they're doing, but my main concerns lie in should we be concerned that the province doesn't trust the OBA about still books? And what is the SU opinion on this decision?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And it's a difficult one to answer. I'll say that. With that being said, I would state on this particular issue, the SU has not taken much of a stance, and I will state the reasons for that. Whether or not you think it's a good thing that the province is sending financial consultants, that's a whole separate matter. What we deal with here is the reality that our institution has not shared the books with us as a students' union whatsoever. If you look at any of the media I've been featured in the last couple of weeks, there hasn't. Every single quote of mine has been along the lines of, we can't comment on the budget because the university won't give us the numbers. And we are still working on that as best we can. So I can't comment on whether financial consultants is a good thing. What I do know, though, is that it's never a bad thing having a third party come in, and if they are truly neutral, actually looking and assessing the situation from a fair point of view. It's no secret that the university spends frivolously in some certain areas, and it might not be a bad thing, as I said, that a third party is looking at what's happening. That being said, though, where the danger of this is whether or not this group is going to have any actual power, whether they're going to be able to push the university into a position where they have to cut this. The moment I heard about this, we as an SU got no heads up from the ministry, which didn't make me exactly happy, but the moment they announced the financial consultants, my first phone call was to the ministry, trying to find out what exactly is going on and why these consultants were coming. What I heard back was that these consultants could only make recommendations. They couldn't make actual decisions. They are making recommendations to the university. They are also going to make their findings public. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know if they're going to release the university's numbers as a whole or they're going to release what they looked at specifically. But anything that's coming public out of that, that is news to my ears and it's beautiful. So if they are making things public at the end of this, then I will be incredibly happy with that, yes. As for your concern about costing the institution money, I can't be sure on this, but I'm almost certain that the government is financing this out of their own book. So ultimately, is this money that they could have given the university? Probably. Is it money they would have given the university? No. And it's not coming out of our own finances here at the Students' Union and all the board president, Guzman.
Thanks for the question, Councilman Muhammad. Madam Speaker, if you look on the third page of my report, you will see that I've attached the Students' Union's press releases to a whole, this group of media regarding the budget cuts and external consultants, etc. If you look at the bottom of the third page, the fourth page, you'll find a statement in regards to UVA's finances, and pretty much at the end of the day, students and the rest of the academy should be privy to this financial information before it's coming. So, yes.
Thank you.
So it's either good or bad.
Vice President Chellen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to Vice President Lala. Since you're acting chair of CAFCON, to take it. I was wondering if you discussed having a council meeting on the U of A budget, where we'll bring either the provost or the vice president of finance from the university. I wondered if you considered having a more public forum, something like, say, substage, or a place where more students could access information around what is happening in the budget, or with the university budget, and if so, what the outcome of that is.
The takeaway from that discussion was actually that the decision will be made next meeting. The thoughts around that was that, yes, it'd be nice to have a more public forum for the presentation, but there was a feeling that the debate and the rest of the agenda should be discussed in a space where it would be easier to have a debate and discussion. So, for example, if it was okay with everyone around the table, where we had a public forum, say perhaps on substage for the presentations, during 15-minute recess, we did that move over to a state session.
Thank you. Councillor Schiavone?
This is to Vice President Chum. I was just curious if there's any online or digital media stuff we could use to share for the Bushmark campaign.
Thanks for the question, Councillor Schiavone. So, I think that can expect to be probably on Facebook friends. So, super awkward. So, your Facebook friend requests, if you're sending one, accept it, mention me. I've shared something on my wall. Yes, you've shared media via our SU Twitter account as well as mine.
I'm UINCB academic. Twitter account that links back to the website www.bebooksmart.ca. The hope is that we can also target those first year students.
Yeah.
With that, those are, I don't know if anyone else was in a situation where they were naive first year students that went to the bookstore the day before class and started buying their $600 worth of textbooks, and now their staff book is still in the cellophane in their closet. They just only have $150 on it. sorry, it's a really frustrating time for my undergraduate, so just had to rehash that. Yeah, people talking about CA, share with first year friends, we're going to be putting in an orientation as well.
Thanks, Sophie.
So friendly.
Thank you. Councillor Patel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to maybe you or someone from CAC. I don't know who does this particular stuff, but I was wondering if there's any news on the minute taker situation, if we're going to go into the fall winter without minute takers, or anything about that.
I'll try best answering that, and then if somebody, maybe Vice President Lane, wants to jump in, feel free. I'm not completely aware of the precise timeline, but as you probably know, and as most of the chairs were aware, there was about a two-month lapse just in scheduling conflicts with all of our recording secretaries leaving town, and so the thought was it probably wasn't a prudent use of time or resources to hire and train new folks for a couple of months, given that everyone else will be back. So I believe they are slowly returning. They're all, as I understand it, coming back to school, so I expect them all to be in place for when school starts. With that being said, I believe there was one at CAC today. I'm not sure if the other committees have had it back. But you can also certainly liaise with Nicole to get precise times as to when your particular recording secretary is coming back. Vice President Lee, or Nicole for that matter, anything to add? No? Okay. That's about all we have. Otherwise, yes, please email myself, Councillor Borden, and or Nicole on that. Councillor Grilke.
It's for VP Academic.
Hey.
Is there anything for the book campaign that Augustana can do?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Councillor.
Don't do it.
I just said it.
So one thing I'd be happy to do is send bookmarks with you to send to your students. The Be Bookmark campaign is about a primary physical presence in the west wing of sub around where the bookstore is. We want to get students to stop and either turn around or consider different alternatives than buying their textbooks new at the bookstore. So the physical presence is primarily located there. We have very few posters on campus, for example. I'm more than happy to send you posters as well, but we're trying to keep it sort of digital. So mostly it's digital materials.
Thank you. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Vice President Challenge. Was curious how the hiring process for the Discover Governance Manager is. I remember reading in your report that either you had just started conducting interviews or had just recently finished conducting interviews. So how many candidates are there, and when will we see a manager? And the second part of that is, how will this Discover Governance Manager compare to the SGA before? Is it just a position name change, or what is the differences between these two?
Thanks for the question, Councillor Hodgson. Because of hiring practice procedures, I can't tell you the number of candidates for this position. It's different than speaker selection, because speaker hiring is sort of under the purview of Councillor Hodgson's to hiring processes, form management. Typically keep it confidential. If you'd like more about the meeting camera, if you're interested in detailed personal information, happy to show that. But when do they start? Ideally, we'll have someone start from next week. A person has been hired, and the unsuccessful applicants have not yet been contacted, so I can't publicly announce who the new Discover Governance Manager is. So that's the boring stuff. The exciting stuff is, how is Discover Governance new? First, it will hopefully play a greater role in supporting students' council and its subcommittees, in understanding governance, a greater role in connecting faculty associations, department associations, and councils. So an example of that is the coordination of something like GovCamp or a second retreat for FAs and councils sometime later in the year. Discover Governance will
now be sort of a facilitator of information rather than a provider of information. Previously, Discovery Governance was in a position where they could and did provide political or partisan advice to student representatives. In other words, in a sense, they took that lobbying student representatives, and we've clarified that they have a neutral mandate, and that when student representatives are looking for information, they can access that through the Department of Research and Political Affairs. And third, is we've created something called the Student Governance Center, which is on the sixth floor of the Student Union building. The Discovery Governance Manager will be responsible for coordinating it, but it's essentially a working group that consists of the speaker, the chief returning officer, the board rep is another member, myself, the Director of Research and Political Affairs in SGS, to bring more cohesive strategies so that we can work on things like filling election vacancies, getting the word out with council, what FAs, what DAs are, and working to address the systemic issues that students have. So, three changes.
Thank you. Councillor Battelle.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for Vice President Chellen. I'm wondering, has anyone ever thought of, and if it's feasible, to have a book fair where students would sell their books to other students? Probably in this room, we have enough books to cover every single faculty. So, like that.
Sorry, Vice President Lau, I think Vice President Chellen has overtaken you in the popularity contest this time around. Vice President Chellen?
That's a question. I think that's a great question, and I think instead of a book fair, what the SU does is we actually have something called Subtitles. It's the used bookstore on the first floor of Sub. We just moved it up there. And it's designed to be sort of a sustainable hub for students to sell their textbooks. There's also other things like the SU and used textbook registry. And one of the things that I'm really excited about is FAs, faculty associations, many of them have used book sales that are sort of faculty specific. I don't know if any of you have seen in business, science, or law the lineups in the first couple of days for these used textbook sales. And those are like discipline specific. Used book fairs are really quite successful, but NDSU is supportive rather than a fair sort of that shop mentality that's just easier for students to drop off their materials and come back and back commission and check later on. So hopefully that fits.
With that, 15 minutes have now lapsed in question periods. We'll close question period unless I see five placards to extend. Not seeing five placards. We just got five placards in. Okay, we'll extend until 9:05. Councillor Mohammed.
So this is a question directed to Vice President Chellen. So Subtitles has a buyback option where you can like, give your textbook and give you money. So my entry semester gave back my sociology textbook I got for $100. They gave me that $4. So can you comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What I might do is, is it too late to put a wait request for information? Just to clarify.
Go ahead and click, yeah.
Sorry. Subtitles or the bookstore?
Subtitles.
Okay, then defer to Vice President Day.
Thank you, Vice President Chelsea. Subtitles does part of the book buyback for the university as well, but we also can sign. But then both options are available for students, so you just chose the wrong one.
Okay, moving on. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question for Vice President Lay. I'm curious, I know a couple of weeks ago you were talking about you were preparing a response to the university's document on how the PowerPoint space was supposed to be used. I'm wondering if that's done and like what our response was and our position is on the building.
Thank you for the question. We finished the document and we sent it off to Bart Becker, who is the associate director of facilities and operations.
EVP.
Associate Vice President of Facilities and Operations. And it's a long document, it's about 9 pages or so. I can expand on it there, but there's a lot of pieces. It was just a response as a discussion paper to spur further discussion and outline the general vision. So generally, we envision you know, our pipeline to be more of a community center where it can bring all people, the students, staff, faculty, and alumni into one area, and with some other stuff. But yeah, I can present it to you more, but then it's very much in flux because it's just a discussion, so it can go in many different directions. So nothing is concrete, but there will be further discussion with the GSA and the facilities and operations people, just to further the vision of North Park.
Thank you. Councillor Hodgson, by his own doing, is now winning the popularity contest. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And my question is for Vice President Lau. I was curious. In the earlier Google Doc you sent out about signing up for photos and pancake breakfast and all that stuff, you also had, I believe, a sign-up for tabling, but now CAC has sent out another doodle poll for tabling, so I'm curious because I've signed up on both. And, like, I don't want to be working as two people. So I'm a little bit confused there. And then I also got an email from WOW about signing up for schedule availability, and I was wondering if we have to fill that out for pancake breakfast, because all I'm really interested in doing this is pancake breakfast, which that takes care of, or do I need further action on my part?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Pastor. I just have a question for WOW first. So WOW, it will be necessary to fill your availability for pancake breakfast, at least for those hours, so they know how many volunteers to expect at what time. And that's the reason why in the beginning, all they did was requesting a lot of scheduling. If they want to schedule along with all the other volunteers to make sure that everything comes in place. As for the clubs for tabling, and the Doodle poll versus the Google Docs was sent out earlier, after a short conversation between myself and Capture, we decided that Clubster was hacked in this and that she wanted to take charge of it, so we will go with the Doodle as the official schedule.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we will close question period. That takes us to item 6A. Graham Hodgson moved that upon the recommendation of Bylaw Committee, Students' Council approve Bill 1 in first reading based on the following principles. 1. Conflict of interest includes any situation where an impartial observer may reasonably question whether the actions or decisions of a member of council were influenced by their personal or financial interests, given the divergence between those interests and their obligations to Students' Council. 2. Members of council determined to be in a conflict of interest via the flowchart must refrain from voting. They must choose to recuse themselves from debate or declare any conflict of interest to council prior to debate. 3. Members of council appointed as a student's council representative to the board of a DFU represent the interests of the student's union, not that dedicated fee unit. As such, they may freely vote on and discuss issues related to that DFU. 4. Students' Council recognizes that most inappropriate conduct related to conflict of interest issues is not malicious and commits itself to resolving conflict of interest issues informally and at the earliest possible step. See the attached flowchart for proposed procedures. And then again, as mentioned, document SC 1309.02 is referenced in these principles and is to be considered as part of the principles. Do we have, as Councillor Graham is not here, I'll get Councillor Hodgson to move it, and do we have a seconder for this? Councillor Douglas, thank you very much. Councillor Hodgson to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'll go over, would the reason for proposing this legislation be...
That's debate. Explaining
what
the purpose of or what it would do or what not would be an introduction.
Okay, so essentially what we intend to do is... through the first point there, you can see we are just defining conflict of interest, what happens in a conflict of interest, as well as a process of resolving a conflict of interest. The flowchart is absolutely beautiful, very nicely visually demonstrates what to do given different cases in a conflict of interest. And yeah, I think I'll leave it at that and move into debate.
Before you go into debate, I just wanted to remind Council, because this says Bill 1, I'm assuming this is the first time we've dealt with a bylaw amendment. Basically, it works the exact same way as, with a couple of minor exceptions that are outlined in standing orders, as Policy Committee. comes to council in first reading. Changes to bylaw are always numbered as bills, so this one is called Bill 1, the next one Bill 2, and so on throughout the year. Changes to bylaws come in first reading as principles. Council can debate the merits of the principles, but not the technical wording, because it's not necessarily the wording that will be included. If that is successfully passed, then it goes to, instead of policy committee, goes to bylaw committee for drafting. Bylaw committee drafts the technical changes and so on, and the wording to reflect those principles. Then it comes back to council in second reading, at which time debate is confined only to whether or not bylaw committee effectively made the technical changes to reflect the principles. So you can't debate principles in second reading. This is the time to debate principles now if you want. If it passes in second reading, then bylaw change takes place. With that, we will open the floor to debate. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'll just go start off by explaining a little bit the reason for these amendments to the Conflict of Interest bylaw. Currently, the Conflict of Interest bylaw doesn't do a great job of defining what a conflict of interest is. I believe it actually doesn't say at all. It just sort of says conflict of interest, or if there, I can't exactly remember, but if the definition is in there, it's very vague. We wanted to give a little bit something a little bit more concrete counselors could work with. Additionally, it never actually says that counselors who are in a conflict of interest have to refrain from voting. I think that's something important to include. But the point of declaring conflict of interest is that you won't vote on an issue that you're in conflict with. So that's an important amendment. That's basically the second point there. It would still allow you to take part in the discussion if you were in a conflict of interest. You would just need to declare it to council, or you can recuse yourself, which essentially just means you don't speak during debate. The third point, I think it's our bylaw committee thought it was important to distinguish DFU representatives as different than someone who maybe had a position on a DFU and just on council. Council appoints councillors to different DFUs to represent their interests and to also because DFUs collect money on behalf of the students' union, so it's important to have our input there. So councillors, DFU representatives it's important for them to voice their input on the DFU when a matter regarding that DFU becomes before council, because they actually are council's information source and council's representative to this group. So we wanted to just expressly state that they are not in a conflict of interest, because it's important to have that input. And then fourth, we just focused on establishing a process on how to resolve a conflict of interest. So basically, if you're in a conflict of interest, here's a flowchart of what you do. If you think someone else is in a conflict of interest, here's just follow the flowchart. It's a very clear way so that people have an easy reference to refer to figure out what they should do when they think a conflict of interest is happening. And that's essentially it. I can go into a little bit more detail about the flowchart if people would like, or as well as other counselors on bylaw can speak towards some of the things we're talking about.
Thank you. Counselor Patel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have another question. In terms of number three, I mean, for my personal situation, now that I'm on the APRD board as the SU rep and also on the DFU review task force, is that, like, I asked this question before if it's going to be a conflict of interest, and now I feel like it clearly is if I'm going to be on the DFU review.
Thank you. Further debate? Councillor Speakman?
I can't speak directly to that specific issue, but I think it's a prime example of like what the flowchart represents, wherein any councillor, if they have any kind of doubts, will just say, like, I don't know if this is, but in honor of full transparency, I will, you know, address that with the speaker or with whoever, and then they can work out together, like, is this conflict or is it not, and is it appropriate for me to vote or not. So that's the reason we want to have this, like, explicitly stated within SU policy or bylaw, so that it's clear and there aren't gray situations.
Thank you, Vice President Woods.
So you can allow Councillor Hodgson to go first, and then he's going to address Councillor Patel's call.
Okay, sure. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To address the point regarding that conflict of interest, I actually don't believe that's a conflict of interest at all. Just in the nature of the DFU task force, I would see more as being one of the DFU representatives, as being an asset. You have experience with the DFU. As a DFU representative, you are not necessarily representing that DFU. You are representing council's interest, that DFU. So by sitting on the task force, you should, again, be representing council's interest, which is in line with, in both groups, what you would be doing. I'm also on the task force and sit on the Gateway at CGSR. So if you would like to talk about this more on sub-council, just to kind of nail that down, I'm more than happy. Because if you think you are, then we should probably talk about that, because I'm going to sit down.
Councillor Schiavone?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps you might even be able to address this yourself, but out of curiosity, in the event you perceive you're in a conflict of interest, after voting occurs, it says that in extraordinary circumstances you may change your vote through motion to council. Does that mean that we would, as a councillor, petition council to allow us to change our vote after the vote, or does that mean that our vote would be, I guess, nullified and then we voted upon?
I'm going to pretend that was a point of parliamentary inquiry, because I think I can try and answer it, but of course the floor is open to debate if anyone else would. Keeping in mind that I can only answer it as best I understand the principles, it's subject to the precise wording. Let me just pull up exactly what it says so that I can... So based on what I'm reading from this, it would not be an automatic right to change your vote. It would require effectively a petition to council, or for council to vote in the affirmative to allow you to change your vote, in which case based on the next sentence where it says council may desire to reconsider any motion passed, that suggests to me that it wouldn't just then be you individually changing your vote. It would be that a motion to reconsider effectively takes place, therefore basically allowing anyone to change their vote if they will. So again, based on my understanding of the principles. With that, we will carry on with the debate. Vice President Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to briefly speak in favor of this motion. I think that it addresses some long-standing holes in our bylaws. I think that it very much addresses, at least part of the issue towards conflict of interest within the Students' Union. And furthermore, my sticking point with this motion is that it, I'm saying I can't speak for other councillors, I think that it came from a committee with very diverse viewpoints. I think there was people represented from all kinds of different DFU groups, as well as just student union experience. And I think that you had two sides that didn't always agree on everything, come to a consensus, and that's what we see before us. So for that reason, I think this is a very good rendition of the conflict of interest bylaw, and I look forward to it passing through.
Thank you. Councillor Schiavone?
I guess on that same note, it says that we may change our vote, but in the actual statement from the bill, it says that members of council must refer to the vote. To me, that means we have to abstain, but if we're given the right to change our vote, it doesn't necessarily say that we have to abstain, so could someone please address that?
Further debate? Councillor Speakman?
Sure. Good point, Michael Hagen. I think that should probably be changed to be more in agreement, because after voting occurs, it shouldn't be that you change your vote. And so that would be the discussion where I think I'm in a conflict of interest and I address the speaker. And then the way that I think that it would go is that either this, that would be up to council whether or not you actually are. So unless you want it to stay confidential between you and the speaker for whatever reason, then it would be basically the same as before, but you say, oops, I voted on this, but now I realize that I'm in this conflict, and then council can decide, yes, we think you are, or no, that's actually okay. And they say, no, that was a conflict of interest, then I would say it would be a motion to reconsider whatever, and you would abstain, because everyone has agreed that that was a conflict of interest.
Thank you. Vice President Challen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to do it for my speaking turn. Councillor Hodgson.
Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Vice President Challen. Yeah, just to reiterate what Councillor Stephen said there, the changing of vote is a retroactive thing, so it's after a vote's occurred and, oh shoot, there's any conflict of interest. There's a couple ways to do that, basically exactly like what we said, either to in extraordinary circumstances, which I believe currently in bylaw says will be determined by, I think, die board. So that's something that we, either council or die board, needs to decide when the circumstances are appropriate, when someone could retroactively change the vote, or council will just reconsider the motion. Generally, it'll just be whatever makes most sense. I think a lot of these issues will be on a case-by-case basis. The idea is to have them happen as little as possible with just raising awareness around conflict of interest and pre-reporting conflict of interest as opposed to figuring it out after the fact.
Thank you. Further debate? Seeing none, we will call for question. All those in favor of item 6A? Any opposed? Okay, that motion carries. Carries either way. That motion carries. And of course is referred to bylaw for second reading drafting. If someone wants, someone on bylaw wants to let Councillor Graham know, that would be fantastic. With that, we move on to item 6B. Graham Hodgson moved that upon the recommendation of Bylaw Committee. Students' Council approved Bill 2 in first reading based on the following principles. One, Students' Council will have a standing committee titled the Nominating Committee. Two, the Nominating Committee will be subject to the rules current Council standing committees are subject to. Three, the Nominating Committee shall consist of the VPA, VPX, and 5 members of Council. Four, the Nominating Committee shall have a quorum of 5 members. Five, the Nominating Committee shall solicit and review applications and recommend the appointment of students at large on GFC, GFC subcommittees, university advisory committees, university executive hiring committees, and the Senate. Six, Nominating Committee shall only recommend the appointment of students to GFC when vacancies still exist after the election. Seven, the Nominating Committee has the authority to determine the application process and criteria. Eight, the Council Administration Committee shall relinquish its role in Senate student appointments. Again, Councillor Hodgson can introduce. Do we have a seconder for this motion? Thank you very much, Councillor Douglas. Councillor Hodgson to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So this is something Vice President Challen brought to the committee, and so I will defer to him to introduce.
Vice President?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, in part, this stems from a question that Councillor Mohammed had four or five council meetings ago around the nature of appointments to bodies like the Senate, for example. So I brought a discussion paper to exec, first to exec, then to bylaw committee, also to council for feedback. Bylaw committee discussed this at two different committee meetings, brought it to IRC as well for their feedback, but unfortunately IRC hasn't had an opportunity to meet yet, and this is the motion that they have in front of you.
Thank you. Any debate? Vice President Challen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I wrote a really long letter to council. I don't know how many of you had the opportunity to read it, but to basically summarize, the objectives are to make it clear to students how they get involved with representative positions. Number two, to give council better oversight on diverse appointment methods for students in representative roles. And number three is to fill the existing governance positions. The piece of research that alarms me perhaps the most is one that our CRO from last year brought to us, which is that there have been vacancies for GFC, students on GFC for the past 10 years, that have averaged about 45% of the seats after two elections. So in other words, after two invitations for students to run an election for GFC over the past 10 years, 45% of the student seats have remained vacant. There has been no votes in them. And so this is meant to provide a streamlined process, one that still gives council authority over student appointments to, in particular, GFC. There will still be a March election. The way this bylaw is worded is that after the March election, if there are vacant seats, that Students' Council would retain the authority through the nominating committee
to appoint students to GFC. Note that it's not final. GFC would choose whether or not they would accept PSU nominations, the same with GFC subcommittees. Overall, though, I really like the idea of a subcommittee of council having as part of its job reviewing applications and being involved in the process with the Senate appointment process. For example, I had no idea where the names were coming from. We had to go on camera. There wasn't, I feel, a level of council trust over how the decisions were made, because they were made by a group entirely external from council, with the exception of the VP external. I think this committee is a little bit larger and has higher quorum standards than some other committees to ensure that candidates appointed to student representative roles are thoroughly reviewed and the council understands where these students are coming from. I also think it's important that we build gaps when it comes to student representative appointment. Right now, there have been cases in the past where I, the VPA, or Petros as president, or the executive committee can have appointed some of these types of student representatives without bringing it to council. And I think the underlying principle here is that council should be able to pick, or has ultimate authority in picking, who speaks for students in these roles. And so that's a key principle here. Otherwise, I'm hopeful that there will be some good debate, and I'm happy to answer as many questions as I can. I'll probably save them up if you have lots. But I didn't, just as a piece of information, didn't receive any feedback outside of bylaw committee or the discussion paper that circulated earlier. So.
Thank you. Councillor Speakman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks, Dustin. So I'm in favor of this motion. I think that it's a really good initiative, and since there have been historically so many vacancies, and it doesn't seem that the student body would be at any great loss by losing things like the election to the GFC, because it's not even being utilized really to its potential. So I'm in favor, and so for these principles, I have just a couple of concerns with step number 7. When I read it, I was thinking that some members of council that would then join the nominating committee would maybe be new to governance themselves. So if, I was wondering if there's any resource personnel that can contribute to the development of like application processes and criteria, just so that they're open enough to the student body in general, and that biases won't become an issue. That would be like my only concern with these principles.
Thank you. Councillor Mohammed?
Yeah, so I fully support this motion. I just have a couple of potential concerns. The first one is that would there be a conflict of interest if someone on the nominating committee got on the GSC? And two, I'm just worried about like status need to be formed. Like, for example, on the Senate, there's a lot of former councillors who are on the Senate. So maybe preferential treatment for first years being nominated on the GFC, so they can gain governance experience and see how governance really is like on the campus. So those are my two main concerns. The first one is there are conflict of interest, if not, that's fine. The second one is avoiding dynasties and encouraging first years to get nominated.
Thank you. Councillor Redman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So while I agree with filling seats on GFC, I don't really agree with having nominations and elections at the same time. I feel that it kind of undermines the elections, and people just say, well, if I don't have to run the election, I'll just make some friends on council and get nominated. And furthermore into that, I'm just wondering what kind of merits you'd be looking for a nominee other than like, oh, they're in the faculty engineering meeting, engineering seats, like what kind of things you'd be looking for? Thanks.
Thank you. Councillor Schiavone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah, I was curious as well why the nomination committee would recommend a student to GFC after the first election, and why they would wait to after a by-election was held, because I believe, so I can be corrected if I'm wrong, but I believe there would be a by-election in fall held, and I believe they'd only missed one meeting of the GFC over the summer. And I was also curious about the point number 5, nominating committee shall solicit review applications and recommend the appointment of students at large on GFC subcommittees, advisory committees, and executive hiring committees in the Senate. Mostly the executive hiring committees, I'm not exactly sure what those are, so if someone could clarify those for me, because I don't really know. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So first off, I'd just like to say I'm in support of this bill, as it was before us here, and I'll try to maybe address a couple of questions that have been asked so far. Going back to Councillor Mahoney's question, just specifically on the kind of dynasty thing, that is true, but I think at least in some roles, specifically GFC, it's important to have students appointed who have experience. Maybe not everybody, but I think that's an important aspect of what in the application process we've been looking for. Mind you, this doesn't have to be a council. You can gather experience through numerous different facets on campus, such as FAs, student groups. There's lots of leadership opportunities available on campus, but it is important to have representatives there who are well-versed in university practice structures and able to be an effective member of GSC. To address Councillor Schiavone's question, at least a bit, regarding nominations versus elections, this was debated at bylaw committee, and we decided it was sort of redundant to have two elections and then a nomination process. Appointees or the students who are nominated to GFC would miss a lot more than one meeting, given the fact that the by-election happens mid to end of September. The nomination and appointment process would take anywhere between a month to 2 months, so you'd be getting into October, November before these people are actually sitting on GFC. As well with this, you would then have to run two big, more or less, training and orientation sessions throughout the year. You'd have to run multiple ones because you'd have to run for two rounds of elections and then a round of nominations, so it starts to get a lot of training. With all the meetings they miss, it takes them longer to get up to speed, and in my opinion, it's just very redundant to have two elections and then a nomination. Like, I'm already slightly uncomfortable with an election and a nomination. To me, they're sort of contradictory things, but I think the way we have it now is at least the best way going forward. To have two elections just seems like a lot of extra bureaucracy for no added benefit.
Thank you. Any further debate? Before I recognize Vice President Challen, I'd like to point out what a great example Vice President Challen gave of utilizing his two speaking turns quite well, so that he didn't have to, if he was sort of the resident expert on the topic, get people to defer to him. So perhaps just something to think about, waiting until sort of the end of the speakers list, when you're one of those people that probably is going to have to speak and answer a few questions at a time to allow questions to accumulate, and therefore using fewer speaking turns. Just a friendly tip. Vice President Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for encouraging all of the councillors to ask their hard-hitting questions after this. I'll try and tackle some of the questions. Councillor Speakman, on resource personnel, I believe we included part of this in the, around supporting council on its subcommittees in the Discover Governance manager job description, and we see it as being an important role of Discover Governance in coordination with partially the CRO's office to work on representative recruitment. That was a big part of the restructure, and so they would provide that administrative support and institutional memory around applications, application forms, processes, the sort of digital side of it, how students access it, distribution, the logistics. That's going to be council's job. Someone's question around conflict of interest. Conflict of interest. No, sorry, Mohammed. Conflict of interest around nominating committee in GFC, or appointing students to GFC. That's a great reason why we are passing a new bylaw around conflict of interest. I think that in cases where nominating committee is doing it to benefit their own interests, and like nominating themselves, for example, or applying and then suggesting themselves to come to council, that's where our proposed policy or proposed bylaws would come into effect, I think, and council and speaker talk about whether disclosure or whether there are other things that play. So I think council would be able to screen purposeful conflict of interest or monarchy building or whatever. Self-selection.
bad governance, stuff like that. Preferential treatments for TFC first years, I think that's an interesting idea. I think that's why the nominating committee has the authority to determine the application process and criteria. Like, I don't think this council should decide that forever, that we should allot a certain set of spots on TFC for first years. I think that like that should be an ongoing discussion at nominating committee based on like the needs of the student body. If it turns out that we just can't engage first years in governance, and that's part of what nominating committee can do to determine how do we get more students, first year student perspectives in governance. And so, like, I agree that that's important. Don't know if it fits at this sort of level. I think that's something that nominating committee could discuss in their standing orders. Back to Councillor Schiavone's point around timelines. They'd miss the meeting of GFC. They'd also miss the September meeting of GFC. And then given that it will take at least 4 weeks for NOMCOM to make a decision and appoint the council, and given you probably want to have the call for applications out for 2 weeks, you're like 6 months down the road from mid to end of September, so putting yourselves into late November, right? Is that enough, right? Mid to late November. Typically, the December GFC is canceled because everybody knows Christmas. Sorry to focus on this holiday. So you've only got like 3 left. So that's sort of the rationale on why we don't wait until after the second by-election. You still have like at least 25% of your seats vacant for those first 3 meetings, 3 or 4 meetings. And what's an exact hiring committee? There are typically policies that require a student representative on hiring committees, senior university administrators. I was on the hiring committee for the university's provost. Vice Provost and University Registrar, and Vice Provost and Chief Librarian, for example. And the selection process for that was kind of weird. That's why it's here. So, things like President searches, Vice Provost searches, where an FA doesn't exist, a Dean search, other staff searches, hiring, students have a spot on that, and we thought, I think that should go to council to pick who should best sit on that committee, rather than.
Thank you. Any further debate? President Kuzma?
And what are kind of, President, the points raised by some of the other councillors in regards to point number 5? I think for the most part, I love this entire motion, but what I would be interested in perhaps amending is the appointment of students at large of GFC after the, let's say, the first round of elections. So,
a request for information.
I'll take that at the end. But my first, I'm not completely sold on the rationale for not allowing GFCs for students who essentially won an election. I think it's a really rich opportunity for, let's say, the random students to get engaged, and the difference between, let's say, appointing students on GFC versus running an election is that for those who really want it, they can choose to pony up and run an election and actually force engagement with students. And for those who, let's say, aren't entirely sure about it or whatever, or they prefer to go through another route, I think having that fail-safe of, let's say, okay, we still have the ability to appoint students on GFC would be an interesting idea. Now, granted, I have not been at these bylaw debates, and the others have probably discussed it a lot more in depth than I have. But I think that might be an interesting compromise, at least allowing for more active and vibrant elections to take place. And, you know, if at the end of the day we still have vacant seats, we can still appoint it. So I think perhaps it would be an all right, decent compromise as having best of both worlds. Just on the
okay.
So, request for information?
Yeah, I'll take it.
Sorry, Mr. President. I just want to make sure that I understand your point correctly. You think that that we should allow for at least like a March election for GFC councillors, and then nominating committee can propose like students to fill those vacancies? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
And is that not reflected in point 6?
You're creeping into debate. I know where you're going with it. I'm going to have to stop you there, but
okay. Sorry. Okay.
All good. Okay. Councillor Muhammad.
I'm just going to say, bringing up that idea, after, maybe appoint them on the condition that they'll be running the by-election, the way the seat, if that makes sense.
so whoever still wants to run will get the seat. And for the 5 minutes, if there's still vacancies, they'll receive. Like, I don't know if any stats right now, but that's an idea that's going to address the interest of the point, but it was demolished by Charlotte, so.
Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. After thinking about it for a little while, initially I wasn't too concerned with having an election and nomination, but the more I think about it, the more I realize that you're setting up different systems of incentive, and I do worry that over time, the fact that you can just wait to get appointed may encourage more people to just wait to get appointed instead of bothering to run. I'm not sure. Maybe that won't happen. Maybe the opposite will be the case. But I do think that that is a potential problem, in that, in a sense, does this encourage people to just, you know, I don't want to go through the hassle of an election, I'll just wait and apply. I mean, I don't know if that is a problem. If it is a problem, can we deal with it? I don't know. But I am very uncomfortable with the potential incentive structure that is being created, and I do worry if eventually it's just all going to be nominations and nobody's going to bother running on GFC elections anymore. But, I mean, I don't know.
Thank you, Governor Kelly, and apologies for the sound effects. Councillor Grilke.
My only question is, if, say, someone runs for a GFC position and is uncontested, and they don't get the amount of votes needed to win that spot, and then they apply to be nominated, isn't that having, like, the nomination completely get rid of the fact of the election? I don't know.
Can you repeat that?
Like, I feel like having a nomination after an election anyway is kind of like taking power away from the election. Yeah.
Be careful.
I'm so scared of
What point do you want me to reach?
No, okay. No, that's not it. I wanted to help you clarify your point.
Okay.
Were you suggesting that if a...
Can I defer to Bastis?
Yes, you can.
I think we, like, Councillor Wilkie, not Gurkel, is suggesting is that in a case where, like, I run, as happened in my first year, I run for science student counselor, I'm not elected, like, students do not vote for me, and then I put my name forward and the nominating committee elects me, because that would defeat the democratic process,
yeah.
I think was what she was hinting at. We talked about that a little bit. No, never mind, this is not part of your speaking journey, so I don't say that.
It's still your speaking turn if you'd like it.
That was my thought.
Okay. Okay, further debate. Councillor Speakman.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. So I think that, like, the critiques, I guess, that we've heard have been good and beneficial. But that it sounds to me like the first principles are at least okay to everybody, but the details can be, like, hashed out later. So that's positive. Also, with regard to, like, whether over time certain students will, like, abuse the system to like, get the easy way in or whatever, I think a couple of things. Like, I'm an optimist, so I would say that people just won't do that because people are good. Second of all, I don't think that it's a good reason to stop the development of this bill, like, in its stages now, because student council can stay on top of this and monitor it into the future. That's not going to be hard. And also, the other thing is that even if that does happen, seats will be filled on GFC. So, like, so, who cares, like, which way they got? So at least their voice, the student voices will be heard, even if the student voices are, like, super conniving into getting there. It's like, well, that's okay, because that's the purpose of the governance. And from what I've seen in my limited experience, everyone here is super committed to, like, fair governance and student engagement, and that's the direction council's going in. So I really don't think that it's going to be become contentious or a nasty problem that we have to deal with.
Are you stretching or are you...
Question.
Call to question. Okay, there's a motion to call to question. Are you seconding that?
Okay.
Call to question requires two-thirds majority votes. All those in favor of calling to question? Any opposed? Okay, that motion carries. We will call to question. All those in favor of item 6B, please raise your placards. Any opposed? That motion carries and will be referred to Bylaw Committee. Again, if someone from Bylaw Committee could inform Councillor Graham so that Bylaw Committee actually drafts the technical wording, that would be fantastic. With that, we'll move on to item 6C. Chellen Woods moved that the Students' Council, on the recommendation of the Policy Committee, approve the Students in Governance policy in second reading based on the following principles. Now, again, this is a policy, so we do first and second reading. First reading was already approved last meeting or a number of meetings ago. The principles listed in here are simply the principles from the first reading, so that they're basically there for your reference. The actual technical changes that have taken place are on the document SC1309.03. Is that a point of parliamentary? Yes, Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think there's a point missing in the principles, because I believe we had an amendment that is not reflected there, unless I'm absolutely blind and can't see it. But I know I see it in the actual policy, but just not the principles. So not a huge deal.
Oh, you mean the principles, we amended the principles and that extra principle didn't get included in, you could be right. Let me pull up a copy of our votes and proceedings just to see if I can sort that out so that you're able to accurately determine whether or not the wording reflects the principles. Okay, I have no idea why this PDF is being so weird and replacing letters, but we should be able to get it. Okay, so we've got a 0.6, or sorry, 7, so 8 here. We added two more on this motion to amend, and we did add an 11th here that was carried. So, apologies for the confusion. There should be an 11th point in here in the principles that says students gain educational benefits for participating in student governance. This doesn't require an amendment or anything because this is the principles here are just listed for reference so that you can refer to them to decide if the technical wording reflects the principles. So just take that 11th principle into account when you're debating. Vice President Chan, is that a point for the...
Is it possible for a mover to make a grammatical amendment before the motion is placed on the table?
Yes, but now that I've read it, it's placed on the table.
Oh, darn it.
as soon as the speaker begins reading it is on there. That being said, if someone moved a grammatical amendment, I would propose it to be... I would ask if it could be moved as friendly, and it could go quickly. So... So again, just a reminder that the attached document is the actual technical changes and debate in second reading is confined to whether Policy Committee accurately reflected the principles in their technical implementation. With that, Vice President Chellen to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We took the principles that Council recommended to us, including the three amendments, and translated them into second readings for a students and governance policy. It's long, it's the fifth last page of your agenda package, if you can find it. That's all I have to say.
Just to make sure nothing's missed, there's one last, be it further resolved, on the next page over, so just to clarify. Opening the floor to debate on second reading. Vice President Chellen. Okay. Actually, before you do, is it the grammatical one? I'll just allow this now. Go ahead.
I'd like to move to amend the third and fourth last be it resolved clauses to say be it further resolved.
Oh, that was actually already changed. That was handled in speaker's business.
Oh.
Next time, pay more attention.
Oh,
he wasn't here. You were right. Thank you, Councillor Brophy. Vice President Chellen, that was indeed added. So, yes, so to answer your first question from before, we're good, and my apologies. With that, any debate? Vice President Woods?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would just like to speak in favor of this motion. Speaking as a student who was very involved in academic governance last year. I can tell you that there is definitely a problem with students having their voices not as heard as, as they should be and not being treated fairly and equitably.
Point of order.
Vice President Chellen.
Just be fair, you're allowing debate on the principles of the motion or just on the interpretation?
That point's well taken. I would remind Vice President Woods that debate is confined to the technical merits.
The policy reflects the principles.
Thank you, Vice President Woods. Any further debate? President Kuzmu? Propose the amendment and
yeah, hopefully I didn't already miss this if I'm dozing off. But that being said, if we could capitalize just to be consistent with the other political policies in our guidebook, if we could capitalize all statements of whereas, be it resolved and be it further resolved. Be it resolved that and be it further resolved that.
Okay, so there is a motion to amend. Oh, sorry.
And on top of that, there are three instances of mentioning SU, just the acronym, whereas the entire policy states Students Union. So just to be consistent with the policy, we can amend those three instances, which is I think kind of the line.
Okay. Not really during a motion, but if you want to put a point of parliamentary inquiry, you're welcome to.
Point of parliamentary.
Yes, Councillor Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So just to clarify, are we're capitalizing, be resolved that the Students' Union, because that is capitalized, or we be capitalized?
No, all caps. So the
all caps. I see.
The motion would be to capitalize. Basically all instances, basically the start of each of the sentences have the words whereas in all caps, therefore be it resolved that in all caps, be it further resolved that in all caps, and then any instance of SU replaced with Students' Union. Is everyone clear on all those grammatical changes that are being proposed in the motion? No questions about that? Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Speakman, thank you very much. Is there any objection to carrying that motion as friendly? Seeing no objection, so carried. Okay. Councillor Nguyen. For debate. No? Any further debate on this item? Vice President Chow.
No.
Okay. President Kuzman.
I'm wondering if this is worth it, but essentially for the last be it further resolved clause, we could perhaps make a friendly amendment for especially for underrepresented groups and change it to perhaps underrepresented demographics or groups on campus.
Sorry, so what? Okay, any further debate? Seeing no further debate, we will call to question. All those in favor of item 6C as amended? All those opposed? That motion carries. With that, we are at the end of our order paper, so I would look favorably upon a motion to adjourn. Vice President Lay, seconded by Councilor Nguyen. All those in favor? Opposed? That motion carries. We'll just wrap up with attendance. President Kuzmu. Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Woods.
You see.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Battelle.
Present.
Councillor Mr. Matthew for Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills.
Present.
Councillor Hanwell. Mr. McCouch for Councillor Bannister. Councillor Schiavone. Councillor Mohammed.
Present.
Councillor Gruelke. Councillor Minarski. Councillor Valdez.
Present.
Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redmond.
Present.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen. Councillor Nguyen is here. Councillor Champagne. Councillor Steve. Councillor Hodgson.
Present.
Councillor Huang.
Present.
Councillor Zhang.
Present.
Councillor Graham. Councillor Binchik. Councillor Douglas.
Yeah.
And I am here. Thank you very much. We are adjourned at 9:42. Have yourselves a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
And again, reminder, if you have any council scholarship nomination forms, now is about the last chance you have to put it in. If you need a couple minutes to finish them up, just let me know.
I'm going to go to the next one.